This program is dedicated to the exploration of the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening while at home or at work on your computer, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and where we might be going than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. For the next 3 hours, you will be traveling safely beyond the limits of mainstream science and religion. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Next week, we will continue our ventures into the very best UFO evidence on Earth today. We'll post our guest's identity on our website this week at x2-radio.com and at bbsradio.com. And you can always read about our upcoming guests there. Go to bbsradio.com and look at the main calendar. It keeps out for about a week or 10 days. And you can read the bios of our upcoming guests in the right or left columns. We want to preserve a little of the mystery for this guest. Trust me, you don't want to miss this one. If you've ever had the feeling we are getting close to global first contact, you need to catch this program next Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern here on X Squared Radio. We also want to let you know that very soon you will be able to receive X Squared Radio on your iPod. We will provide you the content, which you can download or you can stream it wirelessly from our site. We're still working through the details and the cost of bringing this to you, but whatever it is, it will be the best scientific talk radio on Earth. We also want to put a call out to all POD or PDF authors. That includes Author House, Zulon, and any other self-published author that has a story of space, time, human development, or mystery about ancient civilizations. If you have a story to tell, write us. Tell us about it. If we can, we'll provide you a forum from which to tell your story and try to get you started in affecting the universe. We will also add our presence to your publication on our online store. We are going to try to do something that's never been done before to help people start reading and supporting authors because we need your creations. If you're interested in the X Squared Radio profit-sharing program and you fit into our easy guidelines, then drop us a note at x2-radio.com. Next month, the beginning of the month, the final work on Series Segment 1 for the Horizon Project will be complete. Millions of people already know this is the premier documentary series that has such awesome affiliates as the Sci-Fi Channel, the History Channel, and other syndicated outlets around the country. I spoke with Brent Miller, the writer and founder of the Horizon Project, recently, and we'll be working with him on April 5th to help him complete some of the content. If you have any curiosity about the destiny of the Earth and you want to get a copy of the DVD series, you need to go to X Squared Radio and click on the link to the Horizon Project. Well, tonight, I give you a little bit of solar weather, because it's going to get interesting in the next few weeks, and I want to keep you tuned in. Tonight, the solar wind is a mere 365 kilometers per second. Although there are no sunspots visible from Earth today, there was a huge prominence that billowed out into space for no apparent reason other than a coronal hole. This time, the Earth will feel no ill effects, as it was not pointed toward us. We'll feel the effects of that on March 28th, so look for an aurora that night. At 5:35 p.m. on March 29th, you should be able to see a south-to-north satellite passing overhead. This is not a UFO, but rather Iridium number 53. We'll try to keep you posted on that each week as we go along. Tonight, our guest is Art Campbell. Now, Art Campbell is a published author already from the Northwest U.S. He covered primarily mostly pioneer history. Before retirement, he served as a teacher, a coach, and high school principal, so he's got to be tough. Mr. Campbell's writing has been featured in a regional historical quarterly. He has two published books, The John Day Drift and Historical Guide, and Antelope, Saga of a Western Town. These have been endorsed by the state's leading newspaper, The Oregonian. Some of his work has been translated into talking books and into Braille. But his latest book is an entirely different work, entitled UFO Crash at San Augustine. Did a UFO crash on the plains of San Augustine in 1947? This project concerns a probable UFO crash in July of 1947, 165 miles west of Roswell, New Mexico. A rancher gave Mr. Campbell a hand-drawn map showing an area on his property where a UFO had reportedly crashed, and in 1995, Art found what he believes to be this site. We're going to talk about it tonight. I would like to welcome Art Campbell. You're up in Medford, Oregon, aren't you, Art?
That's right, and hello to all your visitors out there.
Excellent, excellent. Well, welcome to X Squared Radio. How are you?
Doing just fine.
Well, we want to know all about this UFO crash. We're interested at this program, and all of our listeners are interested in real evidence that not only have we been visited from UFOs and possibly beings from other planets, but we want to know where the evidence is. We want to know what it looks like. But I don't know geography very well of that area out there. Where are the plains of San Augustine?
Okay, the plains of San Augustine are in New Mexico. Now, I'm an Oregonian, and I had about 1,300-mile drive every time I made a trip down there, one way. And they're in this west central New Mexico, about 165 miles west of Roswell. Oh, within 50 miles of the Arizona line.
Is that close to anything?
Well, actually, it's about 60 miles southeast of nowhere. But actually, the nearest large town is the county seat of Socorro for Catron County, which is about 65 miles away. And there's another little county seat for another county about 40 miles south. So, and we're looking here at our about five-hour drive from Albuquerque for the people who are acclimated to the larger cities.
How did you come across the map? How did the individual that brought you the map?
Well, I passed up something and then ended up getting something else. And I had a chance to visit the Roswell crash site. My wife and I were on a vacation coming back in 1994 from the East Coast. So I did kind of swing down through the Southwest, and I checked to see if they any way of getting out to see where that Roswell crash site was. I'd been working in UFOs for a long time and had retired out of UFO work for about 30 years while I was teaching. I got back into it about 89. Anyhow, in 94 we were out coming across country, so I said, I'll make a few phone calls and see if I could find out where that was. Well, it turns out I got a hold of the rancher, and he was taking a film crew out there the next day at 1:30. And we'd spent the night in Roswell, and he said, if you can meet us out there Sunday. Well, that meant we had to spend one more night in Roswell. Well, Roswell's a nice place. It's a nice little town, but we're getting kind of tired. We've been on the road for almost 6 weeks. So we said, I called this fellow. I said, is there anything else? Well, he said, yes, there's a rancher out there near Dattle, New Mexico, which is right near where we were. And there's supposed to be one went down out there. And he's a pretty nice guy. If you get a hold of him, maybe he can let you go out and take a look at it. Well, it was an offer I couldn't refuse.
And I reckon.
I didn't want to spend another night in Roswell and go out Sunday to see one where hundreds of people had been. Here was one where no one had been. So we chose the latter and got out there about 8:30 in the morning. The guy says, we got to work cattle today. They were loading up the truck, but he said, I'll draw you a map, and you shouldn't have too much trouble finding it. And we had all kinds of trouble. You know, you hit a look and a half down the road and turn at the first station.
No road signs out there, huh?
And there's a fence there. You can't miss it, you know, and this kind of thing. So It took us about an hour to get onto the right roads and down into the area where it was. And we spent about 3 hours there, taking a lot of photographs and so forth and so on. And I found what I thought probably might have been it, but we were kind of anxious to get on the road. It was getting kind of getting late in the afternoon, so I decided to come back at a later time. So that's how it happened. And I came back a year later and found the gap in the sagebrush that had just been cut out clean like a piece. Somebody had gone through there with a 28-foot lawnmower. And there was sagebrush on both sides. Actually, it's called buckbrush. And we started looking around and surveying the site, measuring it, photographing it, and everything. And I was getting ready to leave. And I was photographing the edge of the brush, you know, to get a good, sharp photograph to see where the brush had stopped and the sand started, kind of thing. And I looked out and saw this kind of thing kind of looking back at me. And it looked like somebody had put a pile of chicken fat in the sand. And it had solidified, got hard, about the size of your fist. And I looked down and, what in the world is this? Picked it up, and that's the first thing we found, was this what we call the artifact. We've had it to all kinds of tests, all kinds of medical people looked at it. As far as they could tell, it had been some kind of a container. It had one opening and a little bag, a little stomach. It might have been part of a heart, lung, or something, but it definitely was an artificial material.
Huh.
And it's something very similar to what Tupperware is made out of.
Oh, but they couldn't tell exactly what the material was that it was
made
out of?
Yeah, the material turned out to be polyethylene, which is high-density polyethylene, which is the same material that Tupperware is made out of. And some of the kids' play equipment,
mm-hmm.
Many things in your kitchen, and things like that. But it was an amorphous, meaning it didn't have a crystal structure originally, which would have meant it was rubbery. So whatever this bag was soft, a soft polyethylene. We don't have such a thing. We have, you know, semi-hard, hard, that kind of thing. Even your plastic water bottles today are polyethylene, but they're high density.
Mm-hmm.
But this has been a soft container of some sort, and when it hit the sand, it had gotten hard over the years. And I think there was a lot of wind through there every year, and the cattle coming through had stepped on it and so forth. So there were some pieces broken off of it. But we were able to put it together pretty much, and that's what kind of kicked off the whole thing, was that one find. Then we later found fuse holes. We found all kinds of foil that doesn't meet any known specifications of our own aluminum foil.
Did you have to do any digging to get any of this up? I mean, was it slammed into
the second year we started digging in earnest, and I found a site that had been marked by a little cross. I didn't think too much about it, but I started digging there, and we found pieces of foil, pieces of wax, a carnauba wax, some things like that, and we also found man-made things, of course. But interestingly enough, we found what looked like it might have been a little bivouac or something. Some people would stay there because you find a whole lot of bottle caps together. That means somebody sat there and drank the pop or the beer or whatever.
Hmm.
We're looking at an arroyo here. It was sandy, and I see half sand, sandy loam soil, and very easy to dig. We practically dig it with a garden spade and a little tiny shovel or something. And it had apparently we found some spam cans, things like that. We think it might have been left over from the military, but we're not sure. We did find later on in another spot some military ammunition that might have dropped out of a pack or something, but we don't think they were down there shooting anything.
Well, what made the people in that area think that there had been a UFO crash there in 1947?
Well, the Army was pretty high profile over on the other side of the Black Mountain Range, which would put it at 135 miles over to White Sands Missile Range.
Mm-hmm.
They had taken, during the war, 100,000 of acres down there for their missile testing area, particularly towards the end of the war. And so a lot of people were very wary of the Army coming around on their land for it might take it. So, I mean, you saw a military truck of any kind, you wanted to know where it was going and what it was doing. So every rancher was aware of any military people around their land. So
mm-hmm.
when they showed up down at this one place and then started hauling stuff out, people got kind of curious.
Uh-huh. So appears that the military knew,
right.
or at least had some indication that something had crashed there.
They got in there about noon, but there was two groups of people who beat them there. One was a group of archaeologists that were working at a place called Bat Cave about 10 miles away. And they had, the story goes, had seen something come down that night. And they were setting up a transit, an old-fashioned surveyor's transit they were going to use in the morning for their archaeological work.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people suggested that they aim that where they saw that explosion. They thought it was a meteorite. And they're worth quite a bit of money if you find a big one, you know.
Yeah.
So they aimed that transit over there. It was nighttime. They were sitting around a campfire. And in the morning, they got up and sighted through the transit. And of course, you couldn't see anything, but they knew which way to go because it had a compass on it. So they were able to take that the compass bearing off of that transit and the surveyor's transit and head over there. They got there about 10:30, and another guy who was our key witness named Lannon Grady Barnett was a civil engineer working out of the Soil Conservation District. And he was driving down a highway over there and saw something shiny in the sagebrush. And he was in contact with all of the ranchers because he helped them with their cattle, whatever problems they had, and their weeds, and he surveyed out ditches and things for irrigation. So he was very familiar with what was out in that sagebrush and what wasn't. And we saw this real shiny thing out there. He thought of it as an airplane crash. And the first thing people will do when they see something like that is run out there and see if they can find something. It's about a mile off the road.
Wow,
and
pretty good distance.
Yeah, it was fairly close in. And this was a site the rancher sent me to. And he got down there and found a 30-foot UFO split open on one side, a couple bodies inside, a couple bodies outside.
Wow, did he get any kind of pictures?
No, he didn't. The man didn't carry a camera, and and he pretty well got silenced over the years. We know he told about a dozen people, and four of those people were alive when I started my book.
So he's actually credited with finding the crash site.
Yes, yeah, he's the main person. And just about 15 minutes after he was there, the archaeologist came up from 10 miles away. They'd walked all the way across the plains, by the way, which is a huge dry lake bed. 59 miles long and 10 to 20 miles wide, depending on where you are.
Wow.
And they had to come across there that morning. And they all got there about the same time.
Before the military got there.
The military came in about a half hour later. Shoot everybody out that you didn't see anything.
Oh my goodness. Well, this is fascinating. So he's saying that his original story, that is, that there was about a 30-foot craft there.
Yes.
That had crashed, and that it looked like no one had survived it.
Yes, and there was it was kind of a dirty stainless steel, apparently kind of a pewter color, dirty stainless steel color, and there was a split open, and he didn't know how the bodies had gotten out, but maybe they were alive when they got there. They were 4-foot bodies.
Wow.
Four and a half foot bodies. That I think is probably one of those shoes that we found belong to.
So we're pretty sure that when that happened, I guess the military just cordoned off the area. And
oh, you better believe
heavy.
It. Yes, they cordoned off the area, and a lot of people, they did exactly what they shouldn't have done. They called attention to themselves, came in and out of there with trucks and so forth, and the locals more or less knew what had happened, but not many of them are alive today. But the rancher who gave me the map really wasn't at the ranch at that time. He was going to high school and going to high school up in Albuquerque. This was we think it came down the night of July 1 and 1 or 2, about midnight, probably right about the time of the date change, 1947. Because we found a diary that was written by the wife of the civil engineer who originally discovered it, and it's nothing was in there about it.
Really?
Yeah.
So he didn't go home and tell his wife?
Oh, yeah, he did.
Ah, but she didn't write that.
But I think they agreed. The relatives that I was able to contact, they agreed not to talk about it because they were worried about his job. He'd only been in that job for about a year. He'd been with the Soil Conservation Service since 1935, but only had that one job about a year. They worked real hard to get that job. And he was better off cooperating with the Army, even if they were a little obnoxious about it and him not seeing anything out there. And I think he went to his boss immediately the same day and told him. And they didn't want the Army coming over and confiscating land. That was the main thrust of why they kept quiet.
So you think the Army went in there and literally just dug up the whole area, put everything under tarps, and hauled it off?
I don't think they did a bit of digging. As a matter of fact, I found evidence where somebody had picked up some foil and folded it in the four sections and stuck it back in the sand. I think some of those guys that got in there were a little lazy, didn't pick up some of the metal foil that was apparently laying around. And I'm sure they picked up a lot of it, but you know, it's your last piece of foil to pick up, and you've got a bag full, and sometimes you just slip it under the sand to get out of sight. Well, the arroyo, which is about 300 yards across, and has little water channels down the center of it. With a lot of wind, and occasionally there's water comes through there, and heavy water.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I found was on the surface, it eroded out.
And that's what exposed.
That's what exposed the material that I found.
And, well, tell me just a little bit about the metal. And I've got a caller on the line, but I want to get you to answer
sure.
this question,
okay.
Then we'll bring him on.
Well, it was basically aluminum foil, but it was not of any kind of a foil that we had any, the Aluminum Association knew anything about. It generally had a high silicon and iron content.
But it didn't rust.
No. And we found lots of that foil. It's the same weight as you would, some of it would be in the kitchen. But and some are very thin, some are very thick. But everywhere we dig, it seemed like we dug every day. We come up with we dug there for 5 or 6 years, and every time we dug, we'd come up with a little bit of foil. But it was very expensive to get it analyzed, so we were able to get it an EDX at a metallurgical lab and so forth, and they told us what the content was, and it had about 10 or 15 times more silicon in it than anything that we had. Their silicon level reached about 12%, and we didn't have anything above 0.50.
That's interesting. Well, we have a caller on the line. Caller, where are you calling from?
Brooks, this is Nevin. And the reason I'm coming in as a call-in is because I have a lot of experience around the St. Augustine Plains. And I know exactly what you're talking about. Jill and I lived within 2 hours of that. For 7 years.
Really?
Yeah, and we lived in, it's a little hamlet called Alma, up in the remote mountains there in New Mexico. And we had an experience with a UFO. And I just got so excited when you started talking about it, because we used to see them all the time. I mean, UFOs in that area at night, especially during a certain time of year, is about as common as dirt. I want to describe one to you, and then I'll get off the line.
No, go ahead.
You have to picture a three-dimensional pyramid upside down.
Really?
And this thing was really, really big. It had lights running around the top. And now it wasn't only Jill and I that saw it, the whole campground saw it. Then... You know, we thought it was moving very slowly. At first, I thought it was a balloon, but it was not a balloon. I called a friend of mine the next day up in Reserve, which is about 35 miles away, and he and his brother saw exactly the same thing from their back porch. So, at the same time, we figured out the time. So, given that it was 35, he's 35 miles away, and given what he saw, this thing had to be really, really big.
I reckon so, to see something 35 miles away, even in the sky.
Yeah, I mean, this thing was absolutely huge. We had people out there with binoculars following this thing. the strangest part about it is it showed up again the next morning, and then we never saw it again. It was very strange. Anyway, I got so excited when I heard you talking about the St. Augustine Flames and talked about desolate. That is an extremely desolate area with a lot of small little hamlets that have been deserted. As you drive through it and around it, you'll come across these barns and well, a couple of houses and clumps, but they're all deserted. Nobody lives in the area except down at both ends. That's about it. Okay, Brooks, I just wanted to give you that bit of information. I got so excited. Thanks so much for what you're doing.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks for the corroborating evidence. A few weeks ago, we had Charles Hall on the program, and he worked in Nevada in one of the remote missile range areas, and he had similar stories to tell, that there was a group of individuals, he called them the Tall Whites, that actually lived and worked around in that area for many decades and finally left the area, but he had a lot of interactions with them and wrote about it. So it does seem to be, I guess, because of its remote area and a place where you're not likely to run into any kind of resistance, a place where off-worlders can come and park and do repairs and get things that they need, metal or organics or whatever it is that they need to carry on.
Well, the plains, Brooks, were probably the only flat land for miles and miles. So if I were in trouble in any kind of an aircraft, I'd want to get down there where it's reasonably flat, because everywhere else there were hills, and there were mountains on both sides of the plane. So it'd be desirable for any kind of a plane that was in trouble, or a UFO or airplane or anything, to get down there in an area where it was flat.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. It also, I guess if you're traveling from different planets to this planet, you would have to get used to a different kind of glide slope, because the gravity of this planet is going to be unique compared to any other planet. And if you hadn't studied it for a long time, you wouldn't know that, and you might make a miscalculation. On the other hand, there are all kinds of other things like turbulence in the air and things that other craft might not be familiar with. But I wanted to get back more to this evidence. You still have some of those metal samples, right?
Oh, yes, I have all of them. We just sent over maybe a little quarter-inch sample to the metallurgist, and we'd keep all the rest of it. I think we have 9 different types of foil.
Mm.
And one of our friends might found a heavier piece of material, too. It was also high silicon. It rang like a bell when you hit it. It wasn't foil. It was like about a 16th of an inch thick piece.
Wow, that's really thick. Did you ever have XRF done on it, X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy?
Yes, we did. And I have in my book, I have a section in the appendix where we've gone in and done all the work, including the spectroscopy, and we had it done on almost all of our materials, including the metal. And we have photographs of the metal and the dimensions and have it laid out when we first found it. So the reader who could get a hold of the book, it's actually a CD now. Could get a hold of the CD, would be able to see all of that material.
And where can our listeners find that?
Well, if they're on the internet, there's a place called the UFO Bookstore, www.theufobookstore, lowercase, and they will have it. And the same place will have a mailing address. It's called the UFO Bookstore, 3 words this time, and it's at 1930 Ash Street,
mm-hmm.
Baker City, Oregon.
What was it, Baker City?
Baker City. So we're across Oregon from this here. The UFO Bookstore at 1930 Ash Street, Baker City, like the bread,
uh-huh.
Oregon, and
what's
the zip over there is 97814.
97814.
And later on, we can give out more information. They'll take master charge and what have you, and we have the you can get the copy of the CD delivered to your door for about $16.90, and they'll download it in your computer for about $9.95.
Oh, that's a, so it's very easy. A deal. Instant delivery.
Right.
Well, I like that. So whatever happened to Grady Barnett? Whatever happened to his testimony? Did he ever write a book? Did he do any interviews? Did he
just told friends, and he told a few too many friends, because in about the mid-60s they started hounding him again about being quiet about it. And so early to mid-60s, he said there were several people came by and said that he was talking too much about it. He said, "Well, I haven't really said anything." And he's telling, I don't know why they're coming by. I don't think he was blabbing around town. He was a, by the way, a Rotarian. And some of you people listening out there know what a great reputation Rotarians
have. Pillars of the community, industry
right,
leaders.
Yeah. Service, community above self. And so he was quite an up-and-up person, belonged to a church back there, and the service club, and so forth. And so I don't know why they came by and told him that they to make sure he kept quiet, but they intimidated him enough to where I think he was a little worried about his job. And with that, he had about 2 years after the discovery out there, in 49, he had a serious heart attack. And he managed to get through another 6 or 7 years and retired in 1956 from the Soil Conservation Service, which was part of the Department of Agriculture in those days.
Ah, I see.
So, and he was around till 69 and passed away. He had cancer, and he had a fall and ended up getting pneumonia. And in the fall, had broken some ribs, so I guess it was very painful to cough. And he passed away in 1969. But he told a number of friends, but he wasn't bobbing around town at all.
I'm sure he talked about the craft, and he talked about, you know, the fact that it was found and now it's not there. But what more did he say about the actual beings themselves? Maybe were they humans or were they inhuman, not human?
Well, if any of your readers are familiar with UFO lore, they will hear about they published in the Burlington Moore book in 1980 called The Roswell Incident. It's a book I recommend, by the way, to your readers. It really gets things started off. And Barnett's story is more or less in there. Anyhow, he said that they were 4 or 4.5 feet tall. Here you're talking about a surveyor, and this guy could estimate things down to an inch. So we're not talking, you know, exaggeration here.
Right, right.
And he said they wore a little kind of gray, tight-fitting flight suits, and their hands were bare, and they only had 4 fingers.
Huh. So they weren't human.
They were humanoid, but I don't think... He said it was like nothing he'd ever seen. And
humanoid in the sense that they had 2 arms
well,
and 2 legs.
Let's put this, 4 digits on the hand, 3 fingers and a thumb. Not 5 like we do.
Ah, I see. So they did have an opposing thumb.
Right. It wasn't opposing. It was moved down a little bit, an inch or so lower than where ours is, with only 3 fingers. And said they had pear-shaped heads, kind of funny eyes. And no hair. And he didn't get too much description of them because, you're standing around, it wouldn't take hardly any time at all for the military to come up. You know, the time would go pretty fast. But
were they tall? Were they short? Were they
4.5 feet tall? They're all of them were about 4.5 feet tall.
4.5 feet tall. And
yeah, so,
you said they had gray flight suits on, and the color of their skin was...
Kind of a light gray.
Was gray. So they, I guess, in UFO or alien lore would be called grays.
They're the grays. As a matter of fact,
these were the small grays.
Yeah, he described them to his boss and his wife in 1947. So they didn't come out in the book as grays, weren't described in the general public till 1980 or so. So he was the first one to see and describe grays, apparently. They're quite common. Among people who are into UFO abductions, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
I'm not into that, but the grays are quite probably the most common of the visitors that are apparently here.
Hmm. Now, what about the archaeologists? They came up on the scene too. Did any of them testify, or did any of them save their story or tell about it?
Well, no, that gets into really interesting material, because if you are the archaeologist was a graduate student at Harvard with family and friends surveying a site that he wanted to do a dig at, where they were going to be digging the previous year, 1948. He eventually got to do the dig there, became famous for what they found there. But anyhow, back to your question. They were in a particularly hard bind, because there's just not going to be any money flowing into the coffers of an archaeologist who comes to say he found a flying saucer.
Now, archaeologists not only dig dirt, they get paid dirt, too.
Right, yeah, I imagine so. And so they had to keep it real quiet. And they were, some of the researchers in the 1990s were able to find out that they were in the area because of records, anthropological records and books that were published and so forth. But they said they were not there at the 1st of July, in the early July 1947, when Barnett found his craft. I found a letter from the head archaeologist, and there's only five of them, saying, "We arrived on the plains of San Augustine July 1, set up camp that night." And they must have seen something come over the camp. That's what
they were there.
They were there.
Do you know any of their names?
I know all of the names, yes. The head archaeologist fellow was named Dick, Herbert Dick. And he passed away in early 90s. And there was a fellow named Brown. And Dick later had his wife was with him. Another lady was there, and several other people were there, but they said they were not there the first. Now, that doesn't mean that they found a UFO. It only means that they had declined not to be involved in the timeline that where the UFO obviously came down. But there weren't any other archaeologists around. There were some working south, about 40 miles. But this was the only party that were right in the area. So it pretty well had to be them.
So two groups, archaeologist and a civil engineer, Grady Barnett, come up on the site. They think they've got all day long, because there's not anybody for 50 miles in any direction, to look at this thing and maybe take in what they've seen. And once the shock got past them, maybe they'd have a chance to do a little exploring and tinkering around and see what it is. And then, lo and behold, out of the middle of nowhere, 30 minutes later, here comes the military.
Right. It was a Jeep and what they call the old Deuce.
Oh, Deuce and a half?
Deuce and a half truck.
My goodness.
Two and a half ton truck came down.
Is there a military base not far away from there?
No,
or?
There's not. There was Alamogordo, about 8 miles and over the mountains to the south, and there was Kirkland was up at the in the Albuquerque area.
So how far away would you say the nearest rapid deployment, as it were, military unit would be to be able to
show
up there?
Well, my guess is it would have been out of Alamogordo, the White Sands people, the White Sands area. That was a bigger going base in those days. They probably had more people there. And I imagine that they had probably saw something on radar and sent out a spotter plane. And that's how they were able to get the military there so quick. But with the roads in those days all gravel.
Well, not only that, the vehicles you're talking about have a top speed of about 38 miles an
hour.
Right,
and 30 miles an hour or whatever, and on gravel roads, they'd have been in transit by 6 hours. They'd have had to leave at 5 a.m.
I'd say.
You know, to get there. But they arrived. They said this is a military operation, and everybody clear out. There was a gentleman lived near there on the same piece of property, and they asked him to help clean up a missile crash. Now, I think they hauled a big part of the craft out of there that night. There was a word from a postmistress up at a little town called Magdalena that she saw something go through town about 3 a.m., a big truck, and something on the back covered in canvas. And that would have left this little piece of foil and stuff laying on the ground. It'd be like, you know, going in a movie theater and scattering popcorn all around. You couldn't get it all up unless you had some help, you know. So my guess is that they had people out there picking up materials and taking them with them. And I think in one case, somebody just stuck some stuff under the sand. He can't keep having to pick it up.
And we know about air crashes. Unfortunately, happen from time to time. Unless they just nose into the ground, the debris can be scattered over thousands of yards, sometimes even miles, especially if it's a collision or an explosion that happens up in the air. I know Flight 63 from the 9/11 days, the debris was scattered over an eight-mile area, which doesn't really support the government story that the plane came down intact. It would have had to come apart way up in the air for the debris to be scattered that far.
That's
but
true.
That's another story.
Yes, it is. But our debris here was fairly localized. We could see a skid coming through the arroyo. Even today, you can see a little bit of the vegetation change. And then when it hit the patch of sagebrush, it went right through, plowed right through there. So I had the soil analyzed, and we did 21 test samples to see if there was anything in there radioactive or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
And it turned out to be nothing.
Yeah, well, I think by the time you got there, which was, what, 1995?
Yes,
1995. If the crash happened in 1947, that would be 48 years. Most of even nuclear fuel is going to have a half-life of about 12 and a half years. So it would be fairly inactive by then, but you'd still be able to pick up some daughters.
We picked up some radioactivity, but the guy assured me that it was just background normal. And I even wrote the experience. I was standing out in this middle of this place with this Geiger counter. So you've got to get back by 8 o'clock in the morning. You had to have it at the local college about 50 miles away down Socorro. So I was out there running this thing over there at dusk. I wasn't sure what I was going to find, you know. Wasn't even sure that I would be living at the time I get it back. So, but I was afraid there might be something really heavily radioactive out there, but there wasn't. It was okay. So.
Well, the thing about Geiger counters now, this I know a little bit about this because of the oil and gas industry and, of course, spectrographic research that I've done. Geiger counters have a gas inside of them that when there is a radioactive particle or an X-ray or gamma ray that goes through it, it creates or sputters off an electron, which is picked up by a small filament of wire that goes through the glass tube. That's amplified and creates a tick on your Geiger counter. But you have no idea what species makes that scintillation. What you really need is a sodium iodide crystal and do some actual spectrographic research. Then you can tell whether it's uranium or thorium or sodium-40 and all of these things are daughters of uranium or even heavier elements. But you can, by that frequency, you can calculate what the source was and what the calculation was and if it even was artificial or natural. And any time that I go out into the field, and one of the instruments that I'm putting together for the North Pole expedition in 2007, we'll have a series of sodium iodide crystals so that we can do actual spectrographic research and not just scintillation, which is what a Geiger counter does for you. Yeah, it's kind of down and dirty, and you can tell if it varies from background, but you can't tell what it is. That's the bad thing about a Geiger counter.
Right. Well, I was pretty nervous about it. I had to give the guy my technical credit card to borrow it.
I know. They're not very common. I've got a couple of them here at the house, and I've got one that's got a small crystal in it with an aluminum window that I use. I got it from the old Civil civil defense program. I've got a couple of those laying around. But when I really get serious about it, I go ahead and break out my gamma spectrometer. And it will do alpha particles and even X-ray.
Well, I wish I'd had that out there. I think I had kind of an old device, and it was called a Victorine 290 survey meter using a 489-55 probe. And that was the device that I borrowed from them.
Yep, it's an aluminum probe about 9 inches long,
yes,
about an inch
right,
and a half
right.
in diameter.
Right.
Yep, I've hung one off of a four-wheeler many times out in the woods. It's pretty good for finding fissures in the ground, but not so good for telling what it is. Well, was there anybody else that can corroborate what happened on the planes there, the UFO crash?
Well, those are the only witnesses we knew who were there. But we have some people. Let me go back to this guy who was living nearby there, that they had hired him or at least got him to come clean up the site after
uh-huh.
we got the big dish out of there, I think. And he had married a little high school girl. He was about 20 himself, and married a little high school girl that year over in Arizona, and they were setting up housekeeping there at the rancher's place. The rancher was older and retired and was living down in the Socorro area, and he was staying up there watching his cattle, and they asked him to help clean up. Well, his wife died about a year later, and so he remarried, and I've been in contact with his little, who is still alive, and she said, well, he said that thing had happened about a year after his wife died. A year before his wife died.
Uh-huh.
The crash. Okay. I went to check the local records, found her grave in the cemetery, and she was laid to rest in June of 1948, June 15th, and we figure that the thing happened July 1st, 1947, exactly 1 year. So we were able to corroborate with this unfortunate death of this guy's wife. He died in childbirth, by the way. That gave us a little bit of information. And then there was two colonels from the Pentagon later years. One was called the hell named Lead, and he was a lieutenant at the time, stationed down near Fort Sam Houston, somewhere in the Texas area, and decided to take a little break, and he'd heard about, from a Pentagon source, he was interested in UFOs, and they said, if you want to talk to somebody who's touched one, this came from a guy who was working at the Pentagon,
uh-huh.
go see Barney Barnett of Socorro, New Mexico. He's touched one and seen him. And so this guy decided to take off some one weekend from the fort where he was stationed down in Texas and go up and talk to Barnett. So
he must have been really curious about it to drive that far.
Right. Well, I think he was on his way somewhere. He decided to go through Socorro. But he went through Roswell, you see, to get there from coming up from Texas. And the Roswell thing didn't break 12 years later. They didn't say stop in Roswell and talk to Walter Hott or anybody like that. They said go to see Barney Barnett of Socorro, New Mexico. So apparently Barney was well known around the Pentagon, at least his discovery was. So he went to him, and he got there in 67, a couple years before he died, and he was a lieutenant in those days. And he said he talked with him, and he wanted to see his military identification before he would talk with him. And he thought that he had been let in because Barnett's house,
mm-hmm.
Because he thought he was more brash coming to talk to him about being quiet. And he mentioned that to Lead. Well, Lead's a retired Army colonel now and served in South Korea and other places, and he corroborated the story, and he found out about it from a Pentagon source. He was back in Washington, D.C., declassifying some papers and was having coffee one morning at a Pentagon coffee shop. I think there's several of them there.
I reckon so.
One of the colonel at the table said, you're just in UFOs. And he was looking at something in the paper about UFOs. Well, yeah. He said, well, if you want to know, talk to a man that talked that put his hand on one, go down and see Barnett in Socorro, New Mexico. So he kept that in mind, and when he got down there 5 years later, he went to see him.
How about that? Well, and I have some more questions about that, because if I would have made that trip all the way there to speak to Mr. Barnett, I would have gotten enough information to go back to the Pentagon and ask for some more answers. But I'll ask you those questions in a second. I got about two or three commercials that I've got to do, and then we'll take a short musical break right at the top of the hour, and we will start where we left off, okay?
All right.
All right, have you been to the Discovery Store lately? If you go to X Squared Radio and click on the Discovery Store sign, you'll be amazed at how easy it is to own one of the world's best telescopes. Everyone is excited about star and planet watching. Did you know that most of the comets named in the last 50 years were found by amateurs? On May 7th of this year, the Schwassmann-Wachmann comet, which is a big comet, will pass in front of the Ring Nebula in the Lyra system. Now, the interesting thing about this comet is, for no apparent reason, recently, the head of this comet fell apart. So it will actually stream across the Ring Nebula, and you can watch it for yourself with one of these telescopes. So go to the Discovery Store and get your telescope as soon as you can. Right now, you get free shipping. Who knows? You might save the planet or find the next great comet. Visit the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. Are you interested in stuff for your space? Well, I just bought a leather hand-tooled map for my office. It hangs on the wall. It's of 21st century Europe. It's about 30 inches square, and it has these beautiful wood rods at the top and the bottom that help it hold its shape. It looks awesome next to my Egyptian papyrus paintings. They're on sale right now if you click the Novica link at X Squared Radio. In cooperation with National Geographic, you can find some of the best world art and sculptures at very good prices by visiting Novica at X Squared Radio. And one more thing, I just did this last night. Have you bought inkjet cartridges for your printer lately? Wow. The last time I bought them, I paid $80 to replace the color and black cartridges at a national retail store. That will remain unnamed. Well, no more. Now I do all my inkjet shopping at 123 Inkjets. I bought a color cartridge for less than $20, got free shipping, and got a chance at winning a free computer, or free printer. And last night, I just bought a black cartridge for the same printer for less than $13, and I got free shipping. Forget about those high prices for inkjet cartridges. Click on the 123 Inkjet sign at X Squared Radio and start saving money. Right now, the incredible March Mania sale is in full swing, complete with free shipping for everything. So don't forget to check out their other printer supplies at 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio. Hey, I also want to let you know that Volume 2 of The Ark of Millions of Years, as you know, Volume 1 came out last year. Volume 2 came out this year, about 13 months later. It's entitled 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times. Not only is it now off the presses, it can be purchased everywhere online. Of course, if you want an autographed copy, you still need to buy it from the website at arkofmillionsofyears.com. And make sure you spell that like Noah's Ark with a K. If you enjoyed Volume 1 of The Ark of Millions of Years, which clearly explained the creation of the Earth, you will need Volume 2 to explain why we are here, where we are going from here. If you want to know where the Ark of the Covenant is being held, or how the Sumerian language was found in Bolivia, or how ancient texts testify that off-worlders visited ancient peoples in South America, you need to read this book. My co-author, E.J. Clark, and I have for the first time uncovered information you have never seen before. There is no doubt that off-worlders have been involved with the development and recovery of mankind after a series of cataclysms. You need to get your copy today at arcofmillionsofyears.com. Of course, you can get it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or you can walk into your local Barnes & Noble store and pick up a copy. We will take a short musical break, and we will return in about 45 seconds. Right. And welcome back, Earth Explorers. My guest tonight is Art Campbell. I'm Brooks Agnew, your host, and this is X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We were just about to discuss a colonel. It appears an Army colonel who started out as a lieutenant, and his name was William Leed. And he was, I guess, declassifying some papers while working at the Pentagon, ran across some very interesting stuff about UFOs, wanted to talk to someone who had actually touched one, and was directed to a man named Grady Barnett, who lived in New Mexico and had actually been at the site where this crash occurred in San Augustine. Now, if I was that colonel, and I had made the trip from the Pentagon and down to Texas and then up to New Mexico to meet with this man, go to his house, interview him, and hear his testimony, I think at my rank and obvious seniority in the Army, I would have gone back to the Pentagon and say, I think I'd like to know where you put this craft.
Well, he wouldn't have made captain, that's for sure, if he said that.
Well, I mean, a colonel is next to a general. The next...
As a colonel, he might have done it, but as a young lieutenant, I don't think he told me he didn't want to push it too much at the coffee shop either. So.
I guess he didn't, but I still, privately, even in a clandestine manner, if I had to send unsigned memos around the Pentagon for the rest of my career, I would be looking for the warehouse where that craft was being stored.
Well, it would be interesting to find it. Well, we had actually another colonel. It came out in... 1997 that confirmed the whole thing. This was Philip Corso, which you may have heard about. Some of your listeners may have heard about him also. He was assigned to give alien technology to private industry but before he retired in the early 60s. And he wrote a book called Beyond. Day After Roswell. Sorry.
And, he wrote a book called Day After Roswell?
The Day After Roswell, yes. It's quite well known among you. You can find it in almost any UFO bookstore. It was on the bestseller list for, 15 weeks. I had to wait in line to get into Barnes & Noble. But anyhow, he said that he was on the Art Bell Show in 1997, and... Art Bell said, did any of the alien technology you worked on come from Roswell? The Colonel Corso said it wasn't Roswell, but sometimes I get the idea that some of it may have come from the San Augustine crash.
Huh.
Now, this was 97, 3 years after I started my work, and boy did it catch my ears pick up. And this is the first guy I'd heard that talked about the San Augustine crash. And he was at a conference, and there was another radio interviewer named Ted Lohman, and asked him, this was the same year, were you privy to any other crash sites in Arizona or New Mexico? And Corso said, I was privy to the San Agustin crash and one other dot right down south in Mexico. There were two crashes I was privy to. And then Lohman said again, was that San Agustin crash? Could that have been crashed at Socorro instead of San Agustin in that area? Corso said, no, it wasn't Socorro. It was right down in San Agustin. And Corso had been stationed at the northern end of the White Sands Missile Range at a place called Red Mountain. And it was right near the Trinity site where the first atomic bomb was set off. And he told on the air, he told Lohman, he said, I got a map out and drew a line from the Roswell crash site. It went right through my area and the Trinity site and went right over to the plain of San Agustin. And that indicated to me that they considered that the two crashes, one at Roswell and the one at the plains, as one incident.
How about that? But they were definitely two distinct different episodes.
Well, two craft. They
two
might have
craft.
Collided.
Yeah, do you think they crashed on the same night?
Yes, I think so.
So it's possible that maybe they entered our atmosphere and had some problems, or maybe they smacked into each other.
Well, there's also a lightning storm, and one of them might have gotten hit and smacked into the other one.
Yeah.
See? And so we're dealing here definitely with probably something connected with the Roswell thing, but George Knapp, who was an investigative journalist, said that did a talk one time, and he said, I think the man's telling the truth. He's blessed with a good memory and a sense of honor as well. Corso didn't live past 97. He died, I think, a little suddenly. He was in his almost late 80s when in 97. So he'd come out and written this book and was kind of on a lecture circuit. And sure got my attention when he started talking about the plane to San Augustine. Because I thought I was the only one that was working that knew anything about it.
One of the things that's interesting about this is this might open up a little bit more and might give you our listeners a little more insight into perhaps why this happened in this area. You mentioned the Trinity site, and this, as many listeners know, is where the first atomic gun was tested. In order to make an atomic explosion, and the original test was to make a fission bomb, you had to reach what's a state called criticality, which is where you take enriched uranium, where you've been slamming neutrons into it magnetically to build up its molecular weight and to make it more unstable. You have to slam these two bodies into one another or compress it. It's sort of a little bit like taking a solid steel ball the size of a basketball and compressing it to the size of a walnut in order for the molecules to get close enough so that the protons can touch each other and set off this reaction. Well, for lack of a better way, and they were under a lot of pressure by the government because the Russians were steaming toward Japan, and we were trying to mount an invasion of Japan, which would have been extremely costly in American lives and resources. We'd already been at it for 4.5 years, and on two different fronts, two different campaigns, where the public and the nation was very tired of war, and we didn't want to turn around and have to fight the Russians over Japan. We'd already given up half of Europe and part of Germany. So the team, led by Oppenheimer, was under a lot of pressure to develop this weapon, and so for time's sake, they didn't know how to build shaped charges to compress this stuff. They built an atomic gun, which is, they put two lumps of this enriched uranium on either side of a tube and put some dynamite at either end of the tube and literally fired the two pieces of uranium at each other, and that was the first explosion. I know this because I did my postgrad work at Oak Ridge, and I held in my hand sand taken from that site. I have done spectrographic analysis on that sand myself, so I know the radioactive content of that sand. Interestingly enough, a little over 2 years later, we have this UFO crash not far away from the same site at which the first modern nuclear explosion takes place on this planet. One of the easiest signatures to pick up in space and in time and between dimensions is nuclear explosions. So it does not surprise me one bit that there was a lot of UFO activity around where we were actively, frequently testing nuclear weapons. This is a direction that our planet goes with weaponry. When we ever receive new technology, the first thing the military wants to do with it is make a weapon out of it. And this is true to form. So now we have a lot of UFO activity and alien individuals showing up. And these are just the ones that crashed. We don't know how many there were that were successfully able to come here and leave and take whatever information they needed. Something interesting, though, that you said about Philip Corso is that his job was to do technology exchange, alien technology to civilian industry. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, he worked with a general who was also a friend of his, named Arthur Trudeau, when he went to this certain department at the Pentagon after having several other assignments. Trudeau had a file cabinet delivered down to his office, and he opened the file cabinet, and there was all called his space junk. And apparently there was a headband in there, and things with wires, and things that looked like little ballpoint pens with laser lights in them, and other things that were probably unattached that weren't working. And there was some speculation that he'd given Bell Labs some of the material for the integrated circuit chips. And they came out about a year later, I think, and got patents on that. And,
well, actually, what they got patent on was a transistor.
Oh, that's right, transistor.
And the guy that was working on it, I believe his last name was Shell. He was actually working on rectifiers, and rectifiers are a way of changing AC current into DC. But the type of electronics that Bell Labs patented under this guy's name requires the coating of boron onto silicone. We did not have that capability in this country. There was one lab in England that had the ability to gasify boron and coat it onto silicone, and they weren't doing it. So how in the world Bell Labs suddenly patented the transistor? There are a lot of people that said this was reverse-engineered alien technology.
Well, there have been some investigations by individuals on this, and I think that the jury is still out as to how they got it so quickly. But Corso had some other assignments. He was staff officer of the Plans Division of the Pentagon, and he was staff officer of the Foreign Technology Division, and then he was head of the Foreign Technology Division, where he was asked to take the material out. And then he retired in 63 as a lieutenant colonel, but prior to that, he was with the Psychological Strategy Board, and I have an unpublished document, secret document, in my book from them from 1952. And he worked with the Secretary of the Army Operations Coordinating Board, and I mentioned earlier he was commander of an anti-aircraft battalion, a Nike missile outfit at White Sands, then later in Germany. So the guy was very, very well, very highly placed, and he had a great deal of trust placed in him.
And is he still alive?
No, he died in 97.
97. You know, in,
after giving some talks and getting the book out, but he's gone too. So, but he's the second one that came. You know, that had that just out of the blue talked about the plane in Santa Cruz. He's never been there. And he had to get his information out of the Pentagon, too. So the other colonel got his. And so some of the materials might have been from that crash out on the plane in San Augustine. They asked him if it was from Roswell. He said he thought some of it may have been, but he also said that some of it was, it came to mind, was from the plane in San Augustine crash. Mm. So they apparently got a UFO intact. I don't think they got one that was workable.
So you think some of the stuff that was in that file drawer, you call it space junk, you think some of that came from San Augustine?
That's what he said.
about that?
That's what he told the national on the national radio hookup on the Art Bell show in 1997.
You know, shortly thereafter, well, it was a couple of years after, I guess, and I think it was 2001, Dr. Stephen Greer started a major effort to, he calls it the Disclosure Project, and he's got a fantastic website and a global effort to try to get individuals like Philip Corso and other individuals that have worked in the Pentagon or at Area 51 or maybe some of these civilian labs that were given alien things to reverse engineer to come forth, you know, before their time is done on this earth, come forth, tell the truth, tell us, did things really land here? Have we really been interacting either posthumously or person to person with aliens, either from other worlds or from our world? Because I think there's a fair contingent out there that believes that some of these non-human or close to human races still live here on this planet and have lived here a long, long time. They just don't interact with us. Maybe they live somewhere else, high in the mountains or under the ocean, or even out, you know, in orbit or on the moon or even in the center of the Earth.
So did you get to see the Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
Man, I have three editions of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I have the special edition of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I love that movie.
Well, you know, it was said at the time, and this is ironic, it was said at the time that they were sort of getting us ready to accept life on other planets, UFOs, that kind of thing. Well, recently, in the last several months, there has been a flood of material on the Internet saying that we had already gone to other planets and come back by 1978.
Yeah.
And there's lots of people coming out of the woodwork on this, people from who were involved, and we sent 12 people, military personnel, to another planet as a result of technology found from the Roswell crash. We made contact with them.
Well, many of the listeners of this show know that in one of the most advanced labs in the world, it's called Sandia Labs. They do a lot of technology transfer, but they also have a lot of black ops that they do there. But they announced that they are testing, as we speak this year, testing what they call a dimensional motor. And this is out of the article. It says, if they are successful, I'm paraphrasing, but if they are successful in this dimensional motor test, it will reduce the travel time between Earth and Mars to 3 hours. And it will reduce the travel time from Earth to the nearest star system to 8 days. Well, I don't need to tell you that somehow that's got to exceed the speed of light.
Right.
It's got to be able to slip in between what we call this dimension and do something different. I've been kind of bold, maybe brash, with this radio program, but I have made the statement, and I made it in writing in Volume 2 of The Ark of Millions of Years. I believe that within 4 years we will have global first contact. I think, like you do, that this Philip Corso guy being involved in psychological operations and others like him, maybe they have contacted great producers like Steven Spielberg and others, and have said, look, we want you to begin producing movies, popular movies, that prepare people for what we already know, and that is that not only are we not alone in the universe, but we're going to be visited in a big way very soon. We don't want everybody to panic. We don't want churches to fall apart and people to pile out in the middle of the street and panic like we're being invaded.
Well, the Internet material says they've already come and gone and come home.
Well, those are ones that have left this planet and gone elsewhere. I'm talking about an alien race coming from another world and landing here on prime time for the whole world to see, hello, we're here. By the way, we're related. How are you?
Well, I hope I see it. I've been involved in UFOs since 1959 when I was working with Donald Keyhoe and even talked to President Truman about them. but he was retired by that time. But I'm not expecting to see it in my remaining time with anything landing on the White House lawn or anything like that.
Well, that wouldn't be fair, would it? We've got to be around to see it. I've got to confess, I've been an enthusiast, and so therefore I'm probably not an impartial witness. I wouldn't take the stand and say I believe or disbelieve. But I'm also a scientist, and I love to have samples in my hands. I love to make hypotheses and prove or disprove them. That's what I'm trained to do, and that's what I believe is really the secret to discovering truth, not necessarily going by family traditions or even what I call the religion of science. But show me one. Land it in my backyard. Let me walk inside, look at the instrument panel, listen to your voice, you know, shake your hand, and then I'll believe. I'm not saying I'm a doubting Thomas by any means, because I think it's ludicrous to think that we're the only sentient beings in the universe.
When I first started talking about UFOs in the late 50s, to service clubs and places, I was a college student at the time, and I think they thought I was going to come to a tongue-in-cheek thing and something funny. And when I came in with photographs and the reports and airline pilots and everybody else, I think people were quite surprised. And I think maybe less than 5% of people in those days believed that the UFOs are real and that there was life on other planets. Now it's closer to 50. And
I recently did my own man on the street interview. I interviewed 200 people, some in a manufacturing facility, and 100 people on the beach. I just went up to people and I asked them, look, I'm just taking a survey. I want to know, do you believe in UFOs? I'd say, well, my results were 7 out of 10 people said, well, I don't disbelieve, but I haven't seen one myself. So
that's
could
reasonable
you say thing. They believe in UFOs? Maybe not. It's a little difficult. But you know what their next question was? Do you believe in them? And, of course, my answer was, look, I'm asking the questions here, which would often break the ice and get things started. But all they would say is, look, I have never seen one, but I can't say that they don't exist. Out of the 200 people that I interviewed, I think I interviewed a little bit more than that, not one said they had seen a UFO, but several had said they'd seen lights in the sky that they didn't understand. And some of them said, well, my mother saw something and she told me about it. But in all those people, and it was a pretty broad spectrum of folks, you know, not scientists and not school children, but people that had a fair amount of life experience. For them to be as common as the minister of in Canada saying they're as common as airplanes in the sky, not that many people have seen them. So I think there would still be a level of shock and awe of people saying, holy cow, did you just see that 1,000-yard UFO land in Virginia, and the White House is talking to him right now?
You want to see shock and awe? Let me tell you, that was what I saw on Harry Truman's face when I tried to talk to him about UFOs.
Yeah,
I was going to school.
Harry, tell me about that event. Harry Truman, former president of the United States.
1959,
yeah.
Had a library in Kansas City. And I went to school at the Kansas City Art Institute, a school of design, which is a few miles away. And I was out one day getting some sketches of some old buildings, and his museum had recently opened, the library there in the Independence. I highly recommend anybody gets that far up to the middle of Kansas City, the Kansas City area,
uh-huh.
Go see them. And so I went in one day and I was looking around, and I'd been in the UFO thing for a couple of years. And I was looking at a bust, I think it was a bust of Harry Truman in the center of a room, and off to my right, he entered with the driver.
No kidding.
Yeah. Well, he had been, my father has been a shirt-tail relative of Truman's, and I talk about it in the book, and as a matter of fact, at my father's home, when my father was about 3 years old, Truman played for a wedding of the my father's first cousin and Truman's first cousin. And that doesn't make you relative, but, you know, you can at least speak and nod. Well, anyhow, he walks over, and I had heard where he was very friendly, and so I stuck my hand out. He had to go by me, so, you know.
There were no Secret Service people around him?
Well, no, he was walking right towards me. I was standing still. And so I put my hand out, he put his out, and I said, Truman said very, I think he called him Mr. President, which was the right thing to do in those days.
Uh-huh.
And very nice to meet you. And I said, have you ever, do you know Donald Kehoe?
Who?
He says, Donald Kehoe was one of the early UFO proponents, wrote quite a few books, and was the head of NICAP.
Right.
Okay. And we're leading up to that. And he says, no, I don't believe that it's a man in government. I said, well, he's in charge of NICAP, and the National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomena. Well, he still had shock and awe on his face, but it was starting to get a little clearer that I wasn't going to... Conversation wasn't going to go on very long, and he said, "What is their function?" I said, "They study flying saucers." He said, "Well, Mr. Campbell, it's been nice meeting you, and I got some things to do here in the office." And that was my introduction to trying to get a hold of somebody to see if they could get any information out of them. But later on, 36 years later, I'm doing research at the library, and it turns out that I'd reported this to Donald Kehoe of NICAP. He said, well, can you get a letter to Truman? I said, no, I can't do that. So he sent one himself, put my name in it. And it's in the first chapter of my book. And it in there was Senator Lyndon Johnson and other people. And my name says, I'm informed by Arthur Campbell that you are interested in UFOs. I didn't say such a thing. But anyhow, 36 years later, here's this letter with my name in it. And Kehoe had sent Truman a letter about the UFOs and some supporting documents. And those documents are in the appendix of my book, and it's an unpublished letter that's what starts the book. And I entitled the chapter "The Buck Stopped Here." So we had a little fun with that one. But
you know, I always wonder about that. You look at the presidential process in this country, and we go through our elections, and we campaign, and we sling mud. And we get down and we vote, and then comes the day in January when the new president takes his inauguratory speech and he heads for his new home at the White House. Well, the first thing that starts is a series of briefings, not the least of which is, Mr. President, here are the codes that you need in case of, and you fill in the blanks. But one of those briefings has got to be, by the way, we need to tell you that we are deeply involved and have been for over half a century with a race from another world. But you've got to keep it quiet.
Well, I bet you wouldn't sleep the first night you were president.
I don't think you could keep something like that from
no.
the president.
No.
Because sooner or later, this once political creature is now going to become part of an administration or leader of the free world. And he's going to say, just a minute. Where is this other $128 billion being spent? You forgot to tell me.
Yeah. It would be a shock, all right. That's for sure. I looked that up there and it said in the letter that this was February 3rd, 1959 from Kehoe to Truman. We have been informed from Mr. Arthur H. Campbell of Kansas City that you expressed interest in the subject and in the work of the National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And he went on. And it was a two-page letter, and then four or five pages of material from all kinds of airline pilots and people that came out of the NICAP material in those days. I also was investigated to George Adamski for Kehoe. He's one of the early people who said that he had been contacted by aliens in the desert, and he's one of the real early contactees. But he came to Kansas City, and when I went back to talk to Kehoe in the 59, I think the summer of 58 was.
Kehoe, he was just with this NICAP organization, right?
Right.
So he just collected data. He didn't actually see anything.
In those days, we didn't talk about aliens or abductions or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
We were trying to prove that they were there.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's still my main goal, is say they're up there. Somebody intelligent is in them, but that's kind of where I was coming from. But Kehoe sort of was NICAP. He had a board of directors, and people were on there. He had admirals and generals and all kinds of civilian scientists and people, and it was a whole lot of people. But Adamski, you want to hear about Adamski?
Yeah, let's talk about George Adamski being a contactee.
Right. I have a chapter in my book called George Adamski and the Rock Island 508. And Adamski came to Kansas City in 1959, and there's a UFO study club there that I had been affiliated with, but it kind of broken away and started by NICAP, a group there in Kansas City. And make a long story short, they went down to the train to get him a ticket to Davenport, where he was speaking that night, I believe. And when he came back on the train, he handed his secretary a ticket, said, "You better cash this in. I didn't use it." She said, "Well, how did you get to Davenport?" He said, "Well, the train stopped out here in the railroad yards. A man came up and got me, took my suitcase, and we drove up. We went to Davenport in a flying saucer." Well, this was a tailor-made thing to investigate because here I was in a young college student finishing up school there in Kansas City, and I was interested in NICAP, and I got a hold of Kehoe. Said, "Would you like me to investigate?" He said, "By all means, investigate it." And he sent me a badge. Oh, it looked impressive. And, about 4 inches long, big old silver thing, the NICAP investigator on it. So I started out, I went down to the railroad police's office, and they have a security office. They call it security now, but in those days, the railroad police. And I told the guy who it was and what I was doing. I said, "We're trying to find if this guy was really true." He said, "We'd sure like to know if the train stopped and he got off, because we'd see a lot of people get in trouble if he was able to do that, because they had the certain locks on the vestibule in those days, things like that." So he gave me the name of the train crew, and there was about 7 or 8 of them, the conductor, the fireman, the engineer. There was a brakeman, a chair car attendant. I was able to interview 6 of the 9, I believe, people, and get statements from 4 or 5 of them. Well, the train had not stopped, and there's no way he could have gotten off. And so essentially, this was written up in the NICAP magazine in those days, that Adamski was accused of trying to invent this this contact. He was getting ready to go to London. I think he wanted to tell them something new when he got there. And I think he picked the wrong town to do it in, because we were chomping at the bit to do something for the cause. And when I got this little badge and what have you, we really went to...
That really made you official.
Oh, it really made you official, yes.
And so, I mean, evidently it appears from the testimony that you got from the railroad crew that he had fabricated the story.
The whole thing. Now, that doesn't mean that Adamski fabricated everything about UFOs. I think later on in his life, and this is true of any speaker, you've got to have something new to go out and give more talks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was trying to conjure up something new. He's on his way to London about a month later, and we had him confronted over there in a London hotel by a guy we'd sent the material to, and Adamski tried to grab it, made a real fool of himself. And so this is one time it didn't pay to phony up something. But it was an interesting time. But Kehoe sent the material to Truman, and at the top of the letter at the Truman Library, in Truman's handwriting on Kehoe's letter, it says "file." Now, if Truman didn't know anything about UFOs or anything at that point, he certainly wouldn't be saving the letter.
Yeah, he would have just tossed it away.
But the archivist told me that was Truman's handwriting. Written in red pencil, by the way.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. It's all interesting. I can't believe the detail. I know when you're on the trail of something like that, and you've been inspired by what you sifted through your hands in San Augustine, and now you want to find the rest of the detail, you know that's not the only thing that happened. Did you ever try to track down the actual Army personnel that came and tried to and took away all the evidence that was there?
I wouldn't know how to start, Brooks. I just wouldn't know how to start that. You'd have to run ads in papers, and things, and I'd rather, you know, my hearing that the postmistress had said something about something going through town at, late at night and things like that, I could, you know where these people are living, you know.
Well, that's true. I mean, they're probably not from around there. They enlisted probably in Alabama and ended up in New Mexico.
Right. Yeah.
That would have.
It would be very, very difficult to try to track those down. And we're working on another angle where a fella, I was giving a talk in the Kansas City area. He came up after a talk and told me that he was at the Holloman Air Force Base in 1956, I believe it was, when 55 or 56. When Eisenhower landed, and that Eisenhower met the aliens at Holloman Air Force Base in 1956. And that might have been setting up that exchange thing we talked about earlier. And he was a medical, worked for the Air Force, was an Air Force medic, and was asked if he wanted to go and stand and parade, you know, as Eisenhower got off the plane. And he turned out he couldn't, he was working. But he gave the name of people who were at the base, and apparently they went over. There were so many people at the base that knew about it, they had to call two sessions at the local at the base theater and tell them to all kind of keep quiet. And he knows some people, although he wasn't one of them. He gave me the names of military people who were with him at those days, and we have that as a part of our the back of our in the website we have. We're still looking into it. But even though it's named, it's hard to find to get to track people down.
Well, we hear, you know, all the time events that happen, and evidently there are dozens or perhaps hundreds of witnesses, and, of course, all in an official capacity. And then we never hear anything about it, and conspiracy theorists say, oh, they buried it, and the general public says, well, there's no way that many people could keep their mouths shut. But having been in the military myself, I've got feelings on both sides. They used to bring us into Air Force Now meetings, and basically it was a propaganda meeting. They'd show us what wonderful things that they were doing with the Air Force. And then the people with lower security ratings would leave, and the people that remained behind, and then they would talk about some more serious things. Some of them were infractions, and other things were new technology. Yeah. And we were told, you know, you can't speak to anybody about this. Don't go home and tell your wife. Don't tell your hairdresser. Nothing. And you read about it 2 days later in the paper. So it was it was impossible.
Well, they didn't want you telling them. They had somebody who was going to tell them, okay, but they didn't want you to get the story out too soon. Yeah.
And then you have the idea that, well, they trickle out enough information so that it discredits or creates enough misinformation about what occurred that that people won't put any credulity to it if it really does occur.
But, you know, we hear a lot about that in the UFO circles, the disinformation and so forth. I think that, frankly, there's maybe a little to it, but I think it's just a lot of paranoid people. I think it's a lot of hokum, frankly. People that you sit down back and read somebody's book and say, well, he's been brainwashed, or he's this, you know. And there's enough work that we could get out and people get out and actually do some digging, you know, and look into important things. But sitting back and you know, moaning about conspiracies, heck, we've had conspiracies since Lincoln was shot. You know, there's still stuff secret about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what else is new in government, you know? So I don't think that, sure, there's no doubt conspiracy going on, but they don't really worry me at all. I just go ahead and do my thing.
Yeah, I guess the only thing that really worries me, and I'm just dabbling in this, you know, we don't concentrate on any one subject here, but I have an open call with X Squared Radio. Anybody that has evidence of alien activity and there are probably two or three dozen websites that gather UFO sightings and pictures and things like that. But to me, to a scientist, either the pictures are too clear, they're too blurry, not enough evidence. In order to believe, I'm going to have to see one. I'm not a believer one way or another. I deal in facts and math and things.
There was a guy that came up with sharp pictures. They didn't believe him either.
But when you start talking about testimonies of people that have seen them and then seen beings, and then the military shows up, and the next thing you know, the place has been sanitized. But it's site after site after site. It's the same thing, whether it's mutilated animals or the bones of giants or alien aircraft or technology that's been found in one place or another. It doesn't matter where it is. Egypt, Iraq, Peru, North Carolina. It's the same story everywhere you go. But in your book, you talk about various pieces of evidence. I think you talk about finding little shoes.
Right. It's actually shoe soles.
Oh, shoe soles. Okay,
right.
Tell us about that.
Sure. I'd walked over this little shoe sole a couple times, and there is some human trash comes down this arroyo because there's a town nearby. And in those days, you didn't have trash collectors coming around getting trash. If you're rural, you just got out of sight. So you'd put it in the nearest culvert, and next time it rained, it'd be gone. Well, what was going on out in the desert, where I was working was, well, so I'd find actual stuff there from beer cans and things like that occasionally. And so I just was sure didn't think too much about it. And I got thinking, there's something funny about that. And I went back the next day and picked it up. And it turns out that I had picked up a little, a tiny little shoe, a shoe sole. It was intact. And it had seven layers in it. I had it sent back to Macrone Laboratories in Chicago. And Macrone did some of the work for the Shroud of Turin for the Vatican. So they were the number one forensic lab in the country, and outside of the one at the FBI. I didn't want to send it to the FBI forensic lab. I would never get it back.
Well, that sounds like a conspiracy theory to me.
Yeah, it sounds like another going on. But anyhow, here's some quotes from a shoe manufacturers in the East. I sent them the dimensions and the photographs and everything. Here's one guy says, I'm not familiar with the bone structure of pygmies. It might fit that category. And
How long was the shoe sole?
4 7/8 inches total. You put a 25-cent piece up next to it, and it gives you an idea of the size. And it's only 1 1/8 inches wide at the narrowest spot.
I don't know any feet that small.
Well, neither did anyone else. And one podiatrist said, I've been in practice for 35 years. I've never seen a child's shoe of this size or dimension.
Now, it wasn't the sole of a shoe of a doll. If it was seven layers thick.
Well, yeah, it was sophisticated. There was, I have drawings and schematics of the shoe and everything in the book. And even if drawing of the layers of the shoe. We start out with a kind of a rubber on the base. It wasn't rubber as we know it. It was just a general calcium carbonate, and it had a filler of pigmented with a titanium white. And then the next layer up was woven cotton cloth, plain old cotton cloth. However, it was coated with something different.
The cotton was?
Cotton. There were three layers of cotton in the shoe. And compressed cotton fibers vulcanized into the rubber sole. And the top was the urethane foam, which is similar to what you have on the dashboard behind your car, behind the leatherette and so forth. And then we also found some other cotton had been sold with nylon thread. Now, nylon wasn't discovered are synthesized until about 1935.
By BASF.
Yeah, and so this meant that if it was an earthly thing, it would have to be made after 1935.
Right.
But we have a complete diagrams, and I even have a shoe sole photographed on a Bannock shoe device that they use in shoe stores.
Mm-hmm.
There's a children's Bannock, and there's a ladies' and a men's Bannock. And that's the metal plate that you put your foot on, to get the width and the length of your shoe.
Uh-huh.
And this shoe is four sizes narrower than is known. This little shoe sole is four sizes narrower than is known than anyone makes.
Did they do any kind of radiological test on this? Was there any radioactive part to it?
Well, No, I didn't run the radioactive, but I didn't have that. At the time I had the Geiger counter, I didn't have the shoe. So, no, I don't think any tests have been run on it. But they, but McCrone talked about all kinds of things that they did, scientific things they did on the shoe, and it was very extensive. And it turns out that the materials are some common and some uncommon. And everything we're dealing with here generally has some kind of earthy component to it, but something, a different thing to it.
And when did you find the shoe?
When did I find it? I think I found it in 97, near a little rise. I found some little rubber things that were, came off of it first. They were uphill. That kind of was kind of made it kind of curious about it. And then down below, I found the little shoe sole, and then I found about 100 yards below the gap. I call it the gap that's spaced through the sagebrush. On another trip, about 98, I found another half of a shoe sole that was obviously much longer, had been much longer than this one.
So
we have a whole chapter
of
the book devoted to the shoe soles.
Did it have the same kind of layers, or was it a different construction altogether?
All we found was the rubber layer on the bottom.
Ah.
And they told me that there was the same as the other. So we have from one UFO, apparently, one small tiny shoe, which would fit maybe a gray. But,
and how far away from the actual, what you would speculate would be the actual resting place of the craft did you find the shoe sole?
Less than 100 feet.
Oh, my goodness. So it's local.
Yeah. Less than 100 feet from where they said where Barnett said the craft came to rest. And I think it had been in the sand and had a fly swat come down through there and it exposed it. That's how I happened to find it, just sticking out of the sand.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, how deep have you dug in that area? I mean, have you gone out with shovels or with equipment or...
No, we've only had hand shovels. We had a crew of Navajos in there in 2004 and also in 2005. They were about eight Navajo guys, and we gave each one of them a screen, 30-inch wide screen and a tripod, and just set them to work. And we'd never find anything below 18 inches.
Right.
Which would indicate to us that everything was fairly recent and... a recent date, meaning that it had come into the Royal that recently. Of course, you keep digging down the Royal, your rocks get bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
So we didn't want to get down and get anything too big, but we'd dig a hole a meter square and maybe 18 inches deep, and there was nothing below that at all. So we didn't dig much deeper than that.
Were there any other sightings that you've been associated with or studied other than this one?
No, I've just been kind of your typical UFO investigator buff, and I had, being around the Midwest, we didn't see any UFOs back there at all in those days.
Right.
And in the late 50s when I was started in on this thing. So I was just wanting to visit the site, you know, before I packed it in for my life, and I got out there in this one place and found this gap in the sagebrush and this little... plastic thing that turned out it might be some kind of an artificial body part. I don't know. But inside it was some fascinating material. I found that inside this thing we found some starch, common ordinary starch like you would find in potatoes or rice or whatever. And it had solidified inside there. And I found a piece about the size of a pinhead. Put it under a microscope and found a gold wire that was one-tenth the size of a human hair.
Really?
Right.
This was inside?
Inside the little bag I told you that we'd found of polyethylene.
Huh.
Three layers of polyethylene.
Do you think it was some kind of prosthesis or something to help them survive Earth environment?
Well, Corso said in an article that was written in a UFO magazine that he thought that the aliens had taken biological entities, They call them extraterrestrial biological entities, and added artificial parts. Well, goodness gracious, I'm carrying artificial parts now. I got an artificial knee. My wife's got two artificial hips. So, and I know people with, you know, have internal organs, you know, things like that that are artificial. So, that's not too unusual. My guess is that we also found tiny, tiny copper wires, but these are not visible by the eye, by the way. Couldn't see under the eye, but under my microscope, 400 power microscope, they really jump out. Oh, I was guessing that they might have been, whatever system that this thing came out of, but there might have been a monitoring device that's been swallowed or something, and what we were looking at was a residue after it had biodegraded inside the whatever it was that came in. They did this they sent a little pill that John Glenn went back in station a few years back. John Glenn went back up to one of the shuttles, and it got quite a bit of publicity. And they had a monitor. He'd take a pill every day. It had a little electronic monitor in it, and it sent a message to his belt, and that belt was tied into the ship computer, and then it was also go back to Houston, so they could monitor his bodily functions while he was in space, but. I would imagine that they would, something possibly like that, and we'd have a little wire left over, and that's what I found in there. But that was one of the things that really turned me on with that gold wire. I mean,
I've
got a picture of it in the book that just will blow your mind.
Taking a close look at that, and then you see a gold wire and say, holy crap, this is a food container. Nobody puts gold wire in a food container. What else is there in here? And, oh my goodness.
My thinking is that I got the feeling that it wasn't to do with nourishment, but there is some speculation by somebody said it might be part of the heart-lung combination, the center thing where they said that the aliens had a heart-lung combination. I believe Corso said that he said that he was also involved in some autopsies at Wolverine Hospital. They had a little private lab there where they did some work. He didn't say he was involved in it, but he said he knew about it.
It doesn't seem too strange that there would be an artificial body part. What does seem maybe a little strange is that there would be an artificial body part in the crew member of a craft that's going to explore another planet. Or maybe they're just coming up to the surface to explore. I'm not sure.
Well, the general thinking among people in the UFO field is that these smaller craft, 30 feet and under, are just a little robot craft from bigger one.
Mm-hmm. And sort of like scout craft.
The 30-foot craft is not made for traveling in space. It comes from a larger ship somewhere.
Well, there's a fair amount of categorization now between sightings and between what we know of alien races and other phenomenon that happened on the surface of our planet. One of those is animal mutilations, where it appears that very precise, almost surgical operations have been done on things like cattle, where over and over and over again, over areas spanning not just states but also continents, the same exact sections are taken from cattle and sheep and llamas and rams and other kinds of animals were mostly epithelial areas. And those of you that know anything about physiology or biology, you know that the epithelial cells are the ones that line your mouth, your intestines. They are generally mucous membranes, but the biggest thing that we notice about them is that they have three main qualities that we look for. One is they endospore, for one thing. You know what Escherichia coli is. They have a tendency to endospore and last for long, long periods of time and can be reconstituted. Sometimes they're virulent and sometimes they aren't. The other is they grow extremely fast. You'll notice if you cut your mouth or have a tooth pulled or something like that, within a matter of days, it's healed completely. Well, your intestines are this way and your colon's this way. And more aggressive forms of cancer often start in epithelial areas because these cells divide and have a rather short lifespan, and they grow very quickly. And they're also a great place to get DNA samples because they're just easy to work with and easy to culture. But here we have appearances of grays, and we have these scout craft, and we line up the appearances of the aircraft and sightings with these cattle mutilations, and lo and behold, they line up. And it's you couple that with other evidence that the bodies or the carcasses of these animals are found with no blood. All their blood's been removed, which is a perfect culture medium as well. And the bodies are dropped clean out of the sky. There's no footprints, no tire tracks. When they fall into areas that are wooded, they break limbs out of the trees 30 and 40 feet up in the air. There's animal fur. If the animal strikes the tree on the way down, way up in the tree, there's just no possible way this stuff happens on the ground. So the conspiracy theory is, well, helicopters are doing this and then dropping it out in the farmland. But when you line these up with alien aircraft sightings, they line up rather perfectly. Well, that concludes our second hour. We have one more hour, and we're going to get into a phenomenon called the Zamora sighting, get into some detail on that. And we got some more detail to get into, and then future activities. But we're going to take a very short break here. I got three commercials, and we'll take a short musical break. Grab a glass of water or whatever, and we'll be right back. So here we go. With only a few missions left, the space shuttle fleet will soon be decommissioned. This spacecraft has carried the entire planet into the next millennium with dozens of satellites, probes, and experiments. It has inspired us all. Now, I never got to go to Florida and watch a launch. I doubt I will make it down there for any of the few launches left. I'm just too busy with other things, just like you are. That's why I went and shopped at the Space Store. I have a model of the Space Shuttle Orbiter that's over 25 inches tall in my library. Visitors always stop and comment how fantastic the detail is. I want to keep the memory of this program alive because it represents the best efforts of the human race. You can, too, by clicking the Space Door sign at X Squared Radio. They have great stuff for kids of all sizes, even ones big as me. You got a birthday or holiday coming up? Visit the Space Door at X Squared Radio. You just might inspire the next generation of space explorers. We know from our emails that we get here at X Squared Radio that there are many listeners out there in the business of education. Without your hard work and dedication to the students of the world, there would be no scientists. We would have no space program, no cures for diseases, and no new research into cleaner sources of energy. That's why we at X Squared Radio are proud to welcome our new affiliate, the Academic Superstore. They have every supply that teachers, professors, and researchers might need at rock-bottom prices. Software like AutoCAD, Minitab, Dreamweaver, and all kinds of general software at huge educational discounts. Brand new, in the box, fully licensed. And they also have those neat gadgets, iPod accessories, and models that make educating fun and help students grasp those concepts at the edge of their current imagination. Please visit the Academic Superstore at X Squared Radio. And one more thing. On July 20th, 1969, astronaut Neil Armstrong took the first step into a new frontier. More than 35 years have passed since that historic moment on the moon, but it is far from forgotten. Now, with the renewed interest in space, and especially the renewed interest in exploring the moon again, we are at the beginning of a new era of lunar exploration. Soon, men and women will walk on the moon once again, but nothing will ever compare to that extraordinary first step. Garath's Design proudly presents a limited edition sculpture to commemorate that unique moment in history with a One Small Step Lunar Footprint plaque. If you go to Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio and add this limited edition plaque to your collectibles, you'll be very satisfied. By the way, 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon, they were made by Eagle Scouts. So if you have a Court of Honor coming up and need a very special gift to inspire your scout, I can think of no better purchase. That's Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio. And I want to welcome, I've got a couple affiliates that have just come on. I'm going to go into more detail in subsequent programs. The first one is called Tree Givers. So if you have anyone that you know that you want to have a tree planted in public lands in one of the 50 states, this is the place to go. They can plant trees for those special occasions or for special people. What turned me on to this, I have a friend of mine who's now 96 years old. His mother planted a tree at their farm when he was born. Well, he outlived the tree. The tree died, and he wanted to have something built out of this tree. And he had the most amazing lectern, like a big old pulpit, made at a speaking center in their city. And this thing is about 12 feet across, and it's all made out of this beautiful hardwood, all from a tree that my friend outlived. And I thought that was an outstanding story, so I decided to bring Tree Givers on as a new affiliate. And we have Wildlife Gifts, and we have a brand new one called Wind and Weather. Wind and Weather is the store where you can find the highest quality gifts and gear for the person who loves the outdoors. Compasses, barometers, sundials, fountains, and lots of special gear for extreme weather conditions by great companies like Oregon Scientific, La Crosse, and Rainwise. They're the best at bringing all things weather to you in one spot. You can find all that at X Squared Radio. We will take a short 48-second musical break, and we'll be right back. Are we alive?
We're here.
All right.
No, you're not. You're not alive.
I'm not alive?
I just hit the wrong button.
Oh, that's all right. Music ought to be ending here just any second.
We've got the music on, but Don just made it out of the room, and I can't figure out how to get you back on air.
You're doing a good job, Nevin. Trial by fire. All right. I guess we're back. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Our guest tonight is Art Campbell, explorer of... I think we're back on. I didn't get a countdown from my...
You want to speak to
We're back on?
Yes, we're back on. We just had a little accident here, and you heard a little screeching. It's okay.
No problem. We'll edit it out. I'll start over again. Welcome back, Earth Explorers. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Our guest tonight is Art Campbell, explorer and writer of the book. He's actually written three books. The most recent one is UFO Crash at San Augustin. It can be bought at the UFO store. And we'll provide a link to that at X Squared Radio so that you can find that easily. Just by going to x2-radio.com, find the March 26th interview with Art Campbell, and click on his the website link, and it'll take you right to the book. We'll make it easy for you to find this. At the end of the last hour, we mentioned the Zamora sighting, and I want to see if we can go into some detail on that. When did that happen?
24th of April, 1964. 5:45 in the evening.
Wow, you got it exact.
I got the report here of the Air Force report. I found the Air Force report and some old NICAP papers. And numbered lines and everything. So starts out with just, that's what it starts out with, is the date and time and everything.
So the Air Force can't deny it if it's in their own report. Who spotted it?
Well, Zamora was a police officer in Socorro. Now, Socorro is one of the towns about 65 miles east of the plains. And, by the way, Barney Barnett lived in Socorro. And this is where his office was nearby there, the SAR Conservation Office, that he went out to work at the plains when he was in the field. So the Socorro's little town, I think maybe in those days, something like 20,000 people, fairly small town. But Zamora was a police officer on duty and was down near a gas station on the main drag and saw a guy heading by speeding. And I think it was a Chevrolet or something. And so he gets in and starts after it. And the car turns off, and he loses it momentarily. He comes up to a road which turns out to be an extension of Park Street and saw a big poof of dust ahead of him, about 250 yards, something like that.
Uh-huh.
And he has to go up the hill. He can't see what's on the other side of the hill. So he assumes the car's gone up there and crashed.
Yeah, the car's crashed.
The car that he's chasing has crashed. And then he also remembers there's a dynamite shack up there, and so it might have been just a dynamite cell. He didn't know what it was, but he saw this big poof of dust in the sky and goes over this little hill. It isn't too big, but he has to go up twice. His car is skidding quite a bit. And he gets to the top of the hill, and he doesn't see any speeder, but about 100 yards away, he sees a white egg-shaped craft sitting in a gully on three tripod legs. This egg-shaped craft was about 10 feet high, and I think he said it was something like 7 or 8 feet in diameter.
Oh, that's really small.
Yeah. But there were two guys, apparently guys, in white type coveralls outside looking at something. And when he got out and shut the door, they didn't hear him come up because I guess it was windy that day and the sound didn't travel that far. But when he shut the door within, 100 yards of him, they looked up. And he said they were bigger than kids and smaller than adults. And that's as far as he could talk about the size of.
And they were in white coveralls.
White coveralls, yeah. So they get in this craft, and it takes off right in front of him. And he sees a bluish light, and then an orange light coming out of the bottom of it. And there's apparently something kind of like a jet on the bottom. My guess is it was a jet-assisted takeoff.
So it made noise when it took
off?
Yeah,
it made some noise. And although when it flew, it was silent. We had jet-assisted takeoffs during World War II. But they would use a separate power to get off the ground. But then it flew off, but he saw it flying in the southwest direction. But the details were that as it took off, it burned some vegetation, and there were some marks there, plain marks where the thing had sat. Something very heavy had sat down in this little kind of a gully arrangement, and apparently scared the two occupants off, Now, they must have known they were near a town because this is on the outskirts of Socorro, New Mexico, but there would be no buildings visible in those days.
Right.
I was visiting there last summer and looking across the arroyo about a half mile away, you can see the new Socorro High School. But in those days, there was no building at all out there at all there.
So if law enforcement spots it, I guess this guy was alone in his car, and he never did find the Chevy he was chasing.
No, he never did. He never did. As a matter of fact, the Chevy just dropped out of the picture when he saw the UFO. And there were some other witnesses to it. Some gal pulls into a gas station just about the same time, 5:45 in the evening, and she said, "What in the world was that thing flying over the highway to the gas attendant?" She said, "Oh, we got a lot of weird things around here." And so somebody had seen the thing actually come into that area before Zamorro had discovered it. I talked to Zamorro, and he's still alive and works at the city. He's had several administrative jobs. He's now he's no longer with the police department, but he's is in charge of the sanitation service, I believe, the last time I talked to him.
Huh.
And he doesn't talk much about it, but...
he didn't deny it, though?
No, doesn't deny it at all. He's probably one of the better sightings of anybody that has ever made, because he's credible, he's on duty, he has a sharp mind, he sees details, and he
but
had
unfortunately,
people...
in 1964, they didn't have video surveillance out the front windshield of the car, so there's no photographic proof.
Well, I have a photograph of him with the Air Force personnel in my book.
Uh-huh.
And they have a Geiger counter. It's an old vacuum tube Geiger counter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the newer ones are kind of thin and sleek looking.
Right.
This is in those days they were using vacuum tubes. But he's there with a civilian and an Army major in the book. Now, it doesn't pertain to the book as the planes crash per se, but since it was so close to the planes and I was able to locate this wonderful document, I thought I'd put it in and talk just a little bit about it.
Excellent idea.
And he was quite a good witness. He said the thing looked like a football standing on end.
And what color was it? Was it silver?
White.
White?
White.
So it was white. How about that?
And
it doesn't surprise me that a Chevy would be racing it, but I don't know if... I see all kinds of humorous things that I could talk about right at the moment. Most of my friends that race Chevrolets because the price of getting a junk Chevrolet engine is less than other brands, but... In 1964, I have pictures of Wolfman Jack talking on the radio about it. But it's interestingly enough that these guys would be here in a different shaped craft. They're not grays, obviously.
A little larger than grays, apparently.
Yeah, but did he notice? Obviously, they were humanoid, but did he notice?
He's humanoid,
skin,
yes. He wasn't close
color
to
them. Or
the color.
Yeah.
I believe had on a white coveralls. I think they were what we consider Caucasian.
Caucasian. So they were not grays. They didn't have gray skin. They were Caucasian looking.
From his vantage point, yes.
And it wasn't from around here. It wasn't an Air Force vehicle. It wasn't something that we were experimenting with, and they decided to stop and take off.
There is a speculation that this that there were two craft on the way. Here, and one got lost and had to set down for some reason or other, and that was the one that set down. And another one showed up, a similar craft showed up at Holloman Air Force Base a day later, I believe.
Well, maybe one of them was female and said, "You need to stop and ask for directions." I'm just kidding.
Well, the Zamora would have been a good one to ask directions from, but I don't think that they probably spoke the same language.
And they probably weren't looking for anything that the policeman knew.
Yeah.
Where
the Air Force was out there in 2 or 3 days. The FBI was there. They took scrapings off of rocks. And there's a little kind of a memorial there. Not a memorial, but people have visited there. And I saw where somebody had taken one of those pod things where the thing had set down and outlined in rocks. And then we had a fly spud through that little arroyo, little draw a couple of years ago, and I went back, and there's no sign of anything there now. But it turns out it was right above a big draw over the slight rise from a big Baptist church down there. And so here's this. I went up one night and put a white cross up there. I ran out of material. I was going to put an X on it and fly over it the next day and photograph it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the guy that I rented the plane from said that we couldn't fly any lower than 500 feet, and it was Sunday morning. And he didn't want to buzz at church.
Right.
So so I just forgot about the whole project, but I never knew whether anybody walked back up in there and found that white cross Sunday morning or not. But I had to end up leaving the whole thing up there in the bushes. The white cross, white flagging tape is what it was that
white
they used for aerial survey. But he was one of the top witnesses of all time of UFO crash. Now, Barney Barnett is living in Socorro, and he's living on Park Street. Park Street is the street that the Morrow chased the car out of town on.
How about that?
So Barney Barnett was at home, or at least living in this house on Park Street, when Lonnie Zamora buzzed by in 1964 on his way to Destiny.
How about that?
Two guys in the same town. It just blows your mind to think about it. But
I'm sure he said, "Oh, not again. I'm not going to do this again." How did you get your hands on the Air Force information?
Well, I was going through some old NICAP papers. And I'd been an NICAP investigator, and you end up with stuff in the files and so forth and so on. And I came up with this. And they also had a map that showed exactly where it was and everything. So I stuck it in the book, in the appendix. But since the Morrow was from Socorro, and Barnett was too, I was pointing out that there was, that we weren't, Socorro wasn't just a place where there was nothing ever happened. But this is one of the most famous sightings that he had he called for backup. And he got a highway patrolman up there. And they went down, and this place was still smoldering.
Really?
And
he didn't try to take a shot at it or anything, did he?
Some of the branches were still smoldering, and from the blast of that thing. And so they were able to collect some samples and burnt some of the buck brush and stuff in there, apparently. And then I guess the Air Force was out the next day, and they thought it was one of the most the best sightings they had ever seen. As a matter of fact, they rated him as probably one of the best witnesses that they had, that they'd ever seen. All investigators agreed unanimously the good reliability of the primary witness, Lonnie Zamora.
Hmm.
Now, this was investigated by, at the time, Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Now, who's he?
Well, Hynek was the founder of a UFO group in Chicago. They put out a magazine called the IUR, International UFO Investigator, I believe it is. And he was the chief debunker. He would come up with excuses for why somebody had reported a UFO, what the Air Force thought it might be.
Oh, I see.
And he was the guy who came up with the swamp gas thing. And later on, became a convert. And they started just putting out information about the UFOs are real; they're not phony.
Hmm. And he was. I wonder what converted him.
Well, he said it was just too much evidence to the existence of them, and he was quite well known, very respected. I believe he was an astronomer affiliated with Northwestern University.
Well, now I have a lot of friends that are astronomers. I belong to the Catawba Valley Astronomy Club. We call it catawbasky.org. Got a very nice observatory not far from here. I don't know if you know much about North Carolina, but on the eastern seaboard, we have most of the dark sky. Most astronomers come from either the south or the north to this area because we have on nights when Mars is close by or there's a comet or you want to see the Andromeda galaxy, this is the place where people come. So we have a very active astronomy club, and one of the things that, well, it's kind of peculiar. It's going to sound kind of strange, but I belonged to this group for 18 months, but I wouldn't recognize anybody at Walmart because we're only out there when it's dark.
Right.
And when you drive up, you have to leave your lights off. The only thing you can use is a little red flashlight so that you don't close people's pupils up.
Sure, sure.
Now, of course, years later, we've made friends. But I can't get a single one of them to state that they believe in UFOs. They're just hardcore stargazers, and they just call it bad astronomy. But it's interesting that you have an astronomer that's converted to believing that there are UFOs. And I'm kind of the same way. I haven't seen one myself, but the preponderance of evidence, the testimonies, the passion with which people speak about this subject, evidence upon evidence upon evidence all over the world, I really have a hard time refuting it. But I'm a little frustrated. I really have a tremendous amount of respect and love for Dr. Stephen Greer and his efforts at getting the Disclosure Project going, trying to get the government to release everything that it knows. Surely we are a mature enough race that we could accept, even if they've been hiding stuff from us since 1947, we could accept that the Air Force, the Army, the Marines, whatever, the NSA, if they have a special bureau at Area 51 that deals with these things, we could accept it now. So let's just go ahead and bring it forth.
Well, I think there's a lot of people who agree with you. Dr. Clyde Tombaugh was one of the, he discovered the planet Pluto, if you may recall.
Uh-huh.
And he was one of the NICAP board of directors in 1958. He makes a statement to in the letter that Kehoe sent to Truman, that these things which do appear to be directed are unlike any other phenomena I have ever observed. Other stars in our galaxy have hundreds of thousands of inhabitable worlds. Of course, a star being a sun.
Uh-huh.
Races on these worlds may have been able to utilize the tremendous amounts of power required to bridge the space between the stars. And here was a guy speaking in 1958, an astronomer. Speaking of astronomy, do you know what is located on the upper end of the plains of San Augustine? 26
No.
Radio Telescope, put there by the government in 1978 through 1980.
Are these the telescopes that we see in movies like Contact that kind of
right.
track together? And
Jodie Foster sitting out there on the hood of whatever it was. It was underneath one of those dishes.
That's a Chevy. It's probably, it could be the same year Chevy that what you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's the same Chevy
Sagan
or not, they're very classic looking dishes. Well, there's a lady that works near there at a government office. And I had, was talking to her husband about Civil War reenactment. I found out he was a cavalry reenactor and had been up and down to Texas at some Civil War doings. And she said, well, I saw a UFO. I said, well, tell me about it. She said, well, I'm coming out of Socorro, which is where they went to the doctor. She lives up near Dattle. Dattle's about 30 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And halfway there is the radio telescopes along the highway. They call them the VLA, very large array. They're located on the plain of San Augustine, upper end, and I'm working down on the southern end. And so this was 1980. Two children in the car, and they'd been down to the doctor, and they were coming out of Magdalena, which was about 20 miles away, and she looks up and sees a silvery disc coming behind her and to her left. She said she could see it in the rearview mirror when the trees were in the way. And it's kind of followed her up the highway, and she just wasn't scared, but she wanted to turn out, and the best place to turn out was at the turnout, a few miles ahead of where these radio telescopes are.
Uh-huh.
People turn out there all the time. There's a big sign telling about them, and you can see them off in the distance. I think there's 27 of them. Each one was 85 tons, and they're about $10 million a piece or more. And she said this UFO, a silver UFO about 100 feet in diameter, stopped behind her about a block, while she pulled out, it stopped. Then it took off to the southwest over the top of the radial telescopes.
I wonder if there was anyone inside there taking some readings, thinking,
I don't know, but I have never heard. So I have her picture pointing to the UFO over the radio telescopes on my homepage of my website.
Mm-hmm. And what is the location of your homepage again?
Well, it's my website. Do you want the website number?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, my website is very easy to remember, UFOCrashBook.com. UFOCrashBook.com, and that'll get you to my website.
Well, excellent. Most of the people that are tuned in tonight are tuned in on their PCs or laptops around the world, and those that are listening live. We are also simulcasting on many AM stations. So if you want to call in, talk to Art Campbell and talk to myself about this subject or others, it's toll-free anywhere in the U.S., 888-268-4313. Those of you that are listening in on your computers, it's right there on the website that you're linked into us with. If you're listening on the AM radio, you can make your way to a phone and call us toll-free right now. 888-268-4313. I meant to open those lines earlier in the night, but I got carried away because this subject is so interesting, and I've got 6 pages of notes here. And we will post all the information that we can at X Squared Radio, and that's x2-radio.com. And we'll also post a link and a biography on Mr. Campbell here, and UFOCrashBook.com is his website. His book is UFO Crash at San Augustine. Did a UFO crash on the plains of San Augustine in 1947. Do you think it's a coincidence that they built the VLA on the same site that this crash took place?
Well, there's a wonderful visitor center there, Brooks, and I'd recommend anybody in that part of New Mexico to go up there and look at them. They have a visitor center showing how it works in a little place where they take you in and show you about the workings and so forth. And I remember from the literature I got from the visitor center, they said this was probably one of the most undisturbed places in the world for radio waves of any kind coming in from Earth.
Even still.
Yeah, it's very still and quiet. So they can send radio waves out there easier because it's a very quiet atmosphere, I guess is what they would call.
So they do send and receive from that area.
Well, I don't know what they received, but I sure do know that they've been sending.
Well, I know, at least from Carl Sagan's movie Contact, made from his book Contact, that is a great listening device. And what they're doing, I guess, and part of it is SETI grants, where they're looking for intelligent signals or non-natural signals that come from outer space. And there's another one in Arecibo. And there's another one in the UK and one in Australia. They're all looking for the same thing, trying to find some radio communication in some frequency. But the other thing that they do with these scopes is they map neutron stars and pulsars and different things that put off distinct radio waves around the universe and the galaxy. But most of it's government-funded and grants and such, so they're not looking for anything dangerous or new. That's up to the amateurs like you and me. And we're out here discussing UFO activity, alien visitors, UFO crashes that occur in generally the same area. And I think it's kind of interesting and purposeful that usually this activity takes place in less populated areas of the planet, like the desert or way out on the ocean or in the North or South Poles. But occasionally, don't we see UFO activity around centers of large population, like Mexico City or Phoenix, Arizona? Did you get any testimony from anyone about UFOs that were sighted by more than one person?
I've been in contact with about 30 ranch families. And I have one or two people have seen things, but there's no daylight sightings. And you can't really be sure at night when you're looking at lights what they are. But one or two people have said they've seen some things. Another one said that they saw what looked like a kind of an explosion down on a mountain about 1949. Well, they never got down there to see what it was.
Huh.
And so little things like that. But oddly enough, you would think these people would be either hostile or for the whole thing, and they're just very neutral. These people are really, really great. They're concerned with their cattle and the weather, and nothing gets in the way of that.
Are any of them, have they been victims of cattle mutilations in that area?
I ask about that. No, and one fellow said that he had a relative, an ex-brother-in-law, I think he said, was up in the Colorado area, had been bothered by it several times. But he said they've never seen anything down this area at all. And I said, what does your brother-in-law think? Well, he said, he doesn't talk too much about it, but he thinks that he thought somebody might be monitoring for radioactivity, that they were taking part of the jaw and the rectum and things like that.
That makes a lot of sense, because, I mean, somebody's cataloged how many nuclear explosions took place in that area and in Nevada and out in the desert of where the test sites are, how many nuclear weapons they actually did detonate.
Well, I believe Colorado is in the drift of the natural winds. And most of the, I understand that the cattle mutilations have been in areas that have been where winds could blow from atomic tests.
Makes a lot of sense,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
Well, there were some ranchers there in Socorro that were there when the first atomic bomb went off, and that played some havoc with the cattle. As a matter of fact, they turned the cattle that were standing around that morning sideways towards the atomic bomb 20 miles away, and all the hair turned white on their sides.
Is that right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
And
there's
yeah.
articles about it that they claimed it was an explosion from a magazine, an ammunition dump, initially.
Huh.
But I talked to a fellow named Bursum, and he said his father had lost all 80 or 90 cattle. The government had bought them right away at the market price, and he tried to hold out for a little more. They wouldn't give it to him.
There's an experiment that was done on one of the atolls in the South Pacific. They, of course, evacuated the atoll, set up a small nuclear weapon, and then they extended several barges at regular spacings out into the ocean and tethered them together with a chain. And on these barges, they had cages of pigs. And when they detonated the weapon, of course, the ocean Navy craft that was monitoring the situation was about 15 or 16 miles away. And they, you know, protected them, their eyes and stuff. They were there to observe the blast. The blast went off, and the idea was to take bio samples of all the pigs so that they could see what the effects of the radiation were from the surface blast. But witnesses to that said that the scream of the pigs when the bomb went off would just deafen you. It was just one concert of terror from these animals. So it doesn't surprise me. And incidentally, from that test, 600 miles away in Hawaii, the streetlights went out and all the phones quit. 600
wow.
miles away. This is where they discovered the electromagnetic pulse, the distance that and power that this would have, disruption. So you could see how beings from another world, or maybe another dimension, who knows, would be disrupted by this kind of activity and rather upset that primitives like us are playing around with splitting the atom in the form of weaponry.
Well, you know, the Roswell Army Air Force Base was the only atomic bomb delivery group, the 509th, that had dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
That's correct.
We're based at Roswell.
That's right.
And so there was more than enough interest there, you know, for if somebody was interested in our how we were coming with atomic bombs, we also had the base there to deliver them. The only one in the world at that time, I believe.
That's correct. Not so anymore, though, and more powers are trying to get their hands on those. However, it's not the first evidence of nuclear warfare that we have found on the planet. Archaeological digs as recent as 25,000 years ago show whole communities that were wiped out from thermonuclear explosions. Their bones are still more radioactive than those that were exhumed at Nagasaki.
I visited Nagasaki in 1953. We were in an aircraft carrier that was down at Sasebo, a few miles south of there.
Mm-hmm.
And we went on up there to Nagasaki, and we were enlisted men. And I think we were the only enlisted men that had ever been there that were not on official business. And you would be surprised how well we were treated. And still, they're almost, you can still look for miles and not see buildings.
Wow.
And the guy in the restaurant would hardly let us pay for anything. People would buy us drinks. And, this is a sailor's dream, you know. And but we were told later on that we shouldn't have gone up there. But we were up there in uniform, three of us.
I've been to Japan several times. I've spoken to several old gentlemen who were alive during that time, and they didn't live close to Nagasaki, but told stories of how the government acted and what it enacted out of the people during that time. And I asked him if he had any animosity toward the United States, and he said no, but it might have been out of respect. I'm just not sure. But I've lived in Japan for several months at a time, and it's not the proudest moment of America to say that we did that, but the consequences, I guess, if we had not done that, would have been another
billion lives of both Japanese and American, probably.
Well, that and Russian, too, because the Russian Navy was steaming toward Japan at the very time that the first bomb went off, and they did not turn around until the second one went off. So there was more strategy there than that, and Truman had remarkable courage, or probably took to his grave more stress than any human could imagine, at having been the only man in modern times to have pushed that button. And Lord knows how close we've come to pushing that button again. I wanted to ask you, of course you probably weren't doing it at the time, but if you ever made your way back to Japan, to ask if there were UFO activity in Japan around where those two nuclear events occurred.
Never got back there. I got to England once, but never got back to the Orient. I've always liked to go back there, this doesn't seem to be in the cards these days.
Yeah, well, every time I go, it's in January and February, and it's, of course, the dry season, but it's also the cold season. It's about between 10 and 13 degrees C over there, which is somewhere around 40, 45, 50 degrees, so it's not the most comfortable. But I never seem to stay long enough for the Cherry Blossom Festival, which is what I've always wanted to see. I'm fascinated by the ancient cultures of the world. I've written about it a couple of times and intend on writing some more about it. In 2007, I'll be joining an expedition. My wife still doesn't know why, but I'm joining an expedition to go to the North Pole on a Russian nuclear icebreaker, so that's going to be, I guess, the highlight of my exploratory life up until that point. I'll find out something else to do after that. Maybe they'll have space tourism open by then, and I'll take part in that as well and write about that.
Hey, I didn't mention the cross we found at the site, did I?
No.
About that.
No.
I found at the site, I'd walked over it for several years, at about 1998 or 9, I looked at this, found some little red material, of plastic material in the soil, and it turned out to be part of a child's rain jacket that was buried. But I found a cross that was wired together, And I thought it was two pieces of an old fence or something, and I realized it was a cross that actually had been notched and made with two pieces of juniper and put together with 12.5-gauge baling wire. And one of my first excavations was underneath this cross, see if I could find anything. I found bones, but turned out to be the bones of a deer. and I found some foil and bottle caps and other things there. And I thought, why would there be a cross here? I think somebody, possibly your military guys you were talking about who may have come up there, you know, we're looking here at 15 to 20 people who knew about that crash site. Maybe 10 or 15 of them are military guys. And somebody might have been assigned to monitor that site after they were discharged or something like that. And it looked to me like there were lots of jars around there, but they were all white mouth. There's also white wildflowers. And I speculated in the book, I have a picture of it, a little cross laying on the ground, that it might have been a little memorial. Somebody had brought their children back there to look at this site, who had been there as an adult, you know, when it happened. And, just had a woman or a child's touch. Just couldn't put my finger on it, but, we looked at the lichen on the cross, and it had never been, the lichen was a little growth that you find on the wood and stone around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, the lichen on there was able to tell us that the cross, when it was made, was about 25 years. It had been there about 25 years. And on the bottom side of the cross, there was no lichen, which would indicate to us that all the lichen had grown on the top of the cross.
Right. It hadn't rolled across.
It hadn't rolled. It hadn't been rolled or tossed at all.
It had been there the whole time.
Whole time, yeah. And it was on a prairie dog mound. And the prairie dogs had kept digging and digging and digging as they did. And I think it got knocked over. And partially covered, and I missed it for 2 years. And finally ended up digging there. I had found some very interesting materials, nothing that would relate to a cross, but it was a very kind of a poignant memory of that place, was to find that little cross. I was just sure somebody had come back there and had known those little gray bodies were there and had come back and done something, put a little memorial to them there.
Yeah.
And then it's fallen down. And I found some broken bottles, and I noticed one day that they were all white mouth. A milk bottle, I found part of a fruit jar, I found some other things.
Lots of things wash out there, don't they?
Well, actually, these things were down below the cross, and all the washing stuff would have been down the channel of the arroyo, which was 30 yards away. So this, everything in this area, by the way, this gap area that I was telling to you about earlier that we found in the sagebrush has an 18-inch rise in the center, which means no water would have run uphill.
Right.
From the lowest water course nearby. And there was no water in the arroyo, so it was dry and had been dry for years, many years. And it comes down what's called a braid, and these... This cross was between two braids that had been dry for many years. So it was very interesting to find that material there.
Well, we don't want you to give up. What we really want you to do is we want you to find out where that ship was taken. We want you to get into that warehouse and take a few pictures of it and put it on your website. That's what we want. And we want you to find out where the bodies of the aliens were taken. But I imagine you're retiring from that business pretty soon.
Well, I'm still. The book has got me kind of up and running now a little bit. I was in the investigating for 3 or 4 years in the late 50s, and I started teaching in 1960, and didn't retire till 89. And at the year I retired, I started getting back into the UFO stuff. But that's how we were interested in getting out to the UFO site in 94. But, this has certainly been an interesting investigation.
Well, it has. And I, frankly, had never heard of San Augustine until we researched you out. And I'm excited about it. I have planned several trips in the next couple of years. But I think what I want to do is I want to fit a trip to New Mexico and just try to take in the atmosphere and see if I can meet some of these people that haven't maybe met the mainstream press yet. Here at X Squared Radio, we're part of the BBS Radio Network, and if you don't realize this, the BBS Radio Network is not mainstream. In fact, if it's not mainstream, this is probably where you're going to find it. And I have a great producer in Don Newsom, and he's got a great crew. Nevin's running the board tonight, getting his feet wet, getting his wings, and we appreciated him showing up on the program tonight and telling us his story. We are not necessarily of a complete like mind, but we have a like mission, and that is to try to bring truth to people so they can make up their own minds as they explore the universe and the earth. We're dedicated to that. When I teach statistics and algebra on the college level, one of the first comments that I get from people is, gee, where in the world am I ever going to use this stuff? And what I try to do early on in the class and sprinkled throughout the semester is drop little stories like this so that they can see that there's a lot more to it than just adding numbers together and trying to figure out statistics on things. These are the tools with which we can understand relationships that we have with other civilizations in the universe. To think that we are alone in the universe and that we crawled forth from some primordial ooze by accident, and when we die, we're done. We just don't believe that here on this network, well, nor on this radio station.
Well, I think your radio audience is well served by your great scientific background, because not many people can get into some of the depth of the things that you've spoke of today, and I'm impressed too.
So. Well, I appreciate that. I am not from the entertainment industry like most talk radio hosts. Actually, on a lark, about 10 years ago, I had a friend who was had been diagnosed with cancer. His name was Charlie B., and he had to take some treatments which were going to make him quite sick. And so we had made friends, and he asked me to come and co-host his morning talk radio program with him, which I did, and I learned the board, and I learned the audience a little bit and the genre. And as his treatment progressed, he missed a few mornings, and so I became, by default, sort of the talk radio host in the small town, which slowly built an audience to about 100,000 people. We moved away from there, but my appetite was whetted, and I really wanted to get back to it. So when the opportunity made itself available to me, I expanded and formed X Squared Radio, and the reason I call it X Squared Radio is because a number multiplied by itself is always positive. So X being, you can call it X Files or whatever you want to call it. I thought it was an excellent unknown. Whatever we put into that little mathematical engine comes out positive, and that's what we try to do here. So I bring 20-something years of commercial science to bear, a little bit of skill in speaking on the radio, and a tremendous curiosity that just won't quit. So I appreciate the guests that come on here. I appreciate you coming on here tonight. I know 3 hours seems like a long time, but when we're talking and having fun, it goes by very, very quickly. And you've inspired me. I want to get out to San Augustine. I, for one, never knew the darn radio telescopes were there. Show you how naive I am, but I will get there. I'm going to take some trips here with my wife, and we're going to take in some of this. I've had a marvelous time tonight, and you have an open invitation. Anything that you find in your, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot more of these pieces of evidence go unclassified here in the next few months or maybe years. You're going to get your hands on them because you already have the credentials and a track record, and lots of people know you, and you've got great charisma, and you've also got a good reputation in the business. You're going to get your hands on this evidence, and I want you to bring it to X Squared Radio if you get it.
Well, we'll certainly do. We'll do that if we get some more.
Absolutely. If you want. I did have a couple other questions, but they might take longer to answer than the time we have left. Do you have plans to make another trip down to San Augustine this year?
No, I'm not planning on this year. We've had some health concerns here, and I've got to stay kind of close to home.
Right.
And I'm not planning to go down this year, but I was going to take this year to get the website going and get the book out there. 10 years is a long time to research a book.
Oh, it is.
But I'm ready to get out there and do a little speaking, and anybody that's listening would like a speaker on UFOs, give me a jingle, you know.
We could certainly put an open call out to MUFON. MUFON's got a chapter in just about every state. I was in Roseburg, Oregon. Let's see, it was 1987. I was just winding down. I had a company that I helped form called Crossfire, and I was one of the developers of ground probing radar, used it in the oil and gas industry, primarily because they had the money, and colleges and such really didn't want data like that, and the oil and gas industry wanted to find oil wells and gas wells without drilling a lot of dry holes. So they would call up Brooks Agnew, and I went up there to Oregon and spent 3 weeks using my equipment. And the strangest thing happened. I believe we were outside of Eugene, Oregon, one of the fescue farms there. That's one of the top places in the world to grow fescue sod because of the tremendous depth of the topsoil. Anyway, we were looking for a natural gas well so that this farmer could cut his energy costs, and we scanned up there for a couple of weeks, and we got back into the ravine where it looked like there'd been a lot of geological activity in the past, maybe ancient past, and it was the first time that I had actually boosted the power of my stuff up to about 45 watts. Normally I dealt about 10 or 20 watts, but this time we boosted it up to 45 watts, and it was very foggy that day, and we'd sent the rover out, which was a four-wheeler with a broadcast unit on it, and we communicated by radio, and I watched him on my computer screen because I was picking up his radio signal, and he got out about a mile away from where our camper was set up, all the equipment in the dry, and I had him turn the unit on, and not 30 seconds later, the ground rumbled. It was a small earthquake.
Oh, wow.
Somewhere around, I don't know, maybe 4 on the Richter scale. It rumbled the camper and knocked a couple things over, and I thought maybe they were doing some dynamiting in the area for a road, but I found out later that there wasn't any such thing going on, and that somehow when I turned on the equipment, which was a mile and 3/8 away from the camper, it just seemed coincidental that when we turned it on, an earthquake happened.
Well, that's a pretty powerful equipment you've got there.
Well, it's not the power, it's the frequency. It is constructive interference. It does not take much power to create a resonance. And that's when I really started doing research into the danger of using focused radio beams. And not long after that, they built the HARP weapons system on the North Slope of Alaska. And that's kind of where my shift from being a commercial scientist to being a testifier on various documentaries on the HARP weapons system, because I did some calculations and came up with a phenomenon called a solar tap, which is, I don't know if you do any lightning research, but there's a company out there called I can't remember the name of it now, but they have a rocket that they shoot up with a wire tethered to it, and it makes lightning strike in that spot, and then they measure. They do great experiments with it. But what they do is they form the artificial ion path between the thundercloud and the ground so that the lightning will strike right at that spot.
Sounds like a modern-day Ben Franklin with his kite, huh?
Exactly. And they fire the rocket up about 2,500 feet, and you've got a nice wire path between the thundercloud and the ground, and boom, the lightning strikes right there, and they get a great measurement and a great photograph. Well, I calculated a way to do that with radio waves, and that's exactly what HARP is set up to do, and Unfortunately, it wouldn't be going into a thundercloud. It would be going into the entire ionosphere of the Earth.
Well, there's some recent studies. They thought that the Roswell craft, one or two, were hit by lightning. And then there's some Taiwanese research within the last couple of years where they've discovered that above a lightning bolt, for some 60 miles, is a charge of electricity going up.
That's correct. It's called a red jet or a blue sprite.
Right. And there's some speculation that our UFOs got caught in that, rather than below the lightning cloud. They were caught in that that discharge coming up from the lightning bolt.
It's possible, but I checked the weather on that day of the Roswell crash. There wasn't any weather. We have about 1.5 minutes before we have to end the program. Is there anything else that you would like to leave the listeners with, a final note?
Well, I like your note of optimism, and I think reasonable people will inherit the Earth, and they just do reasonable things. And so if any of your listeners have anything out there that they're working on or something, just keep plugging at it. I noticed earlier you were talking about 7 of the 11 astronauts were Eagle Scouts.
That's correct.
I just came back from a museum yesterday where I was talking to a guy, and I'm also an Eagle Scout. And he has a museum of all the scout lore and so forth. It was just quite a look back in the past.
Yeah, actually, 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts.
Yeah,
now,
I thought, well,
some people might say, "Well, gee, that's an unfair fraternity," but I say that there's only one of the best places to get a man of integrity is from a boy of integrity, and one of the best places to make a boy of integrity is the Boy Scouts of America.
I agree with that. Maybe I could leave the UFO store address again if I have time.
Absolutely.
1930, the UFO store, 1930 Ash Street, Baker City, Oregon, and that's zip code is 97814, and they have a website, and it's the www, the UFO store, all in one word, in lowercase, .com. And
it's theufostore.com.
Right. And that's their their website.
All right.
You shouldn't put the V in there.
We'll make sure we get it on. We're out of time, but I appreciate you being on. Art Campbell was our guest tonight. I'm Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Remember, Earth Explorers, who you are, and remember that everything we do will eventually affect the universe. Let's do it on purpose. Peace, Earth Explorers. Good night, Art.
Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.